This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. John Holland. Today is July 28, 2010. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Holland is joining me by phone from Missouri. Okay, why don't we begin with a little bit of biographical information. If you could, tell me a little bit about when and where you were born.
I was born in Poplar Bluff, Missouri. September 1st, 1937.
All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names and what did they do for a living?
Okay, my father was Ernest Holland and my mother Alfia. And they both were natives from Poplar Bluff.
Mm-hmm.
My dad attended Harvard for a brief time and University of Michigan, a couple of his schools, and sold food products on the East Coast till he moved back to Poplar Bluff in the sometime in the 30s.
Okay.
And they married in the early 30s.
All right. So did you grow up there in Poplar Bluff?
Yes, I did.
All right. Could you talk a little bit, I guess, about growing up and what that was like for you as a kid there in Poplar Bluff?
You know, those were... Those are the good times. I just take the telephone, for example. We had an exchange of four numbers, and you'd pick up the telephone and tell the operator mm-hmm. who you wanted to talk to, four digits. And then she would connect you to whomever you wanted to talk to. If you wanted to make a long-distance call, you called the operator and told her who and in what city. And maybe sometime in 15 to 30 minutes, they would call you back and say, we have that party on the line.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Of course, you watched the radio then.
Mm-hmm.
There really wasn't much television. And you could drive around town all night on a gas that cost you probably 25 to 30 cents.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Much calmer, easier life, not as organized, no particularly organized little league baseball or anything like that. We're just kind of on our own and pick up games. And
mm-hmm. Right.
You look back on it now and you say, it was a pretty easy time.
Right.
Didn't have to worry about thumb drives and things of this nature.
Mm-hmm. Right, yes, sir. All right. Well, you mentioned baseball. Is that what you primarily did for fun as a kid? Or?
As a kid, you know, I'm a big Cardinal fan.
Okay,
and,
right.
Summer times when I was in elementary school and junior high, if I wasn't out playing softball or something, I was home listening to the Cardinals.
Mm-hmm.
But yes. In high school, I played football predominantly.
Okay. All right. Where did you go to high school?
Went Poplar Bluff.
Poplar Bluff High
school. School.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Of course, the big thing going on at the time when you were a kid was World War II, of course. Do you have many memories of the war?
Yeah, I do. Actually, my dad joined he joined early 42. He was an interesting guy because he was, when World War I broke out, he was about 2 years too young. Joined
mm-hmm.
on his own, and my grandmother wouldn't sign the papers.
Okay.
So he never went, and he was a very frustrated person. And as soon as the war broke out, he was almost too old.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
he actually couldn't pass the eye examination, he told me, and he knew the doctor that was the optometrist and obtained the eye chart in advance, memorized it, and got in the Navy at 38 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And then I was, you know, still pretty young, but we moved to Great Lakes, which was in 42, I guess, and lived on the base for a while. It was the largest Navy training installation in the world at the time. And he was in charge, he was a supply officer in charge of a galley, and then we subsequently moved to Berkeley, California. He was at Treasure Island. And, yeah, I remember quite a bit about it. I do remember, you think recycling is recently new, but I can remember as a 6 and 7 year old with a wagon
mm-hmm.
pulling around the neighborhood getting tin cans and glass for the war effort to be recycled.
Right. Yes,
and,
sir.
And there were some ships in there and going down looking at them. And he was subsequently transferred. He volunteered for sea duty and wound up going to Norfolk on the other side of the country on a refrigerator ship. And my mother and I were basically stuck in Berkeley, California for the duration.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, your father's service and growing up in this time period of World War II, did that have an impact on you as far as an interest in the Navy and in the military in general?
Yeah, it really did. Jason, it had the whole impact on me because when World War II ended, there was literally millions of people in the service, and the budget didn't accommodate that. So my dad only had 3 years, and he was 40-some years old, 41, 42, and so he was going to leave. They were going to let him go, as they did millions of them.
Mm-hmm.
They were just too old to get into the pipeline for a career. And
right.
He was a lieutenant. They gave him an honorary release and promoted him to lieutenant commander.
Okay.
But he had a love for the Navy his entire life. And, you know, as far as I can remember back, he just kind of drilled in me, well, you are going to go to the Navy. You are going to go in the Navy.
Right.
And, you know, it's something, one of these things that you never really give it a second thought.
Mm-hmm.
You just have it in your mind. And when I was a senior in college, another friend of mine I went to the University of Missouri,
okay.
Columbia, and we went down the road to St. Louis to a recruiting station and signed up and took our physicals, and we were already on the dotted line before we graduated.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, before we actually get into to your decision to join the Navy,
uh-huh.
we could talk, I guess, a little bit more about this early time period and growing up. Let's see. You said you went to Poplar Bluff High School?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And you graduated in what year did you graduate?
1955.
1955. All right.
I think if you remember the TV series Happy Days.
Yes, sir.
That was 55.
Okay. All right. Well, did you pay attention to developments after World War II with the oncoming of the Cold War?
Oh, yeah. You know, the Cold War started, and of course, Korea.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I knew several people. I was about 2 years too young to go in for Korea. I probably would have just, you know, as soon as I got old enough, I would have probably joined.
Okay. Yes, sir.
I was that well indoctrinated into the military. And back then, everybody was, I think, much more patriotic than they are now. That's just the way of life. Maybe it's my ancient thinking or something. But I had a lot of friends that joined as soon as I got out of
mm-hmm.
and went in with Korea. And then I had a number of them joined right out of high school, but that was post-Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So, already signed the armistice. And it's interesting going back to reunions and seeing the number of people in my high school class that were in the military and the number that actually retired from the military.
Mm. Oh, wow. Yes, sir. Right. All right. Well, your time there at the University of Missouri at Columbia, what did you major in there?
I was in business administration.
Okay. All right. And you went there from 55 to 59? Or?
Well, I actually went to Washington University in St. Louis.
Okay.
For one semester. I tried my hand at playing collegiate football and played for Carl Snavely, who was a well-known coach at Wash U for a semester. Wash U is sort of the Harvard of the Midwest academically.
Okay.
And between pledging a fraternity and playing football and some rather difficult academic courses, I didn't do really well in the grades.
Mm-hmm.
And so I elected to transfer before I was asked to transfer. At midterm of So that would have been January of 56. I went to Mizzou.
Okay.
And graduated from there in August of 59.
Mm-hmm. Did you play football there at Missouri?
You know, I walked on. Yeah, I did. I
okay.
played, don't know how you're familiar with the various coaches, but I was lucky enough to play for three of the most well-known coaches in the U.S. at the time. Don Faro was the, it was his last season. I walked on in the fall of 56,
yes,
and I was on the scout team. In other words, we ran the plays at Oklahoma and Nebraska
right.
against the first and second team. And then in spring ball, Fro retired that fall, and then they brought in Frank Broyles, who later became very well known at the University of Arkansas.
Right, right.
And so I played spring ball for Frank Broyles,
mm-hmm.
and then started to fall two-a-days, and I was a walk-on non-scholarship guy, and I went out there for the first 2 days, and I was so beat up after I said, I'm not coming back. So my fall football that year was limited to two practices, and then I said, that's it. I'm going, hanging it up.
Right. Yes, sir. What position did you play?
I was a 185-pound guard.
Okay.
And linebacker.
All right. Yes, sir.
Even in those days, it was undersized. But our biggest guy that I remember on the whole squad was 230.
Right. Well, times have changed.
Yeah, they have. It's remarkable.
Yes, sir.
I would no more think of going out there now
mm-hmm.
for 1 5-minute session at 185.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, sir. Well, you still a big football fan?
Oh, I like it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yep. Right.
Like the Big 12 or whatever they're called now since Nebraska and Colorado depart.
Right. Yes, sir. I assume a Missouri fan?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
Big Mizzou fan.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Let's see. You graduated from college then, and what year was it?
That's in August of 59.
August 59, okay.
Yeah, it took me an extra summer school to get out, Jason.
Okay. Yes, sir. And then at that point, directly into the Navy?
That's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Where did you go through your basic training?
Went to Newport, Rhode Island for the Officer Candidate School.
Okay.
That's where they have all the OCs going through.
Mm-hmm.
Went there in September 59 and got commissioned in February 60.
All right. Could you talk a little bit about what Navy OCS was like at that time? I guess if you could talk a little bit about the daily routine and just what it was like for you.
Okay, sure. Yeah, it was. Of course, we got there in the fall. It went through the dead of winter. And you got to know Newport, Rhode Island in the dead of winter is a miserable place to be. That's number one.
It is, right.
Number two, the Navy, as opposed to like the Marine Corps or the Army, was basically academic. And there was very little, there was some drilling, and not much physical endeavors are involved in it. It was mostly classwork. And you wake up and you drilled. We were in companies, and there were 900 and some officer candidates in our company,
mm-hmm.
our class, I'm sorry, and it was a four-month program.
Okay.
And so we would wake up and drill to breakfast and then go back to the barracks and get your books and stuff and then drilled from one class to the next. And at that time, they were all World War II wood frame buildings.
Okay.
Drafty, you know, and everything that goes with that kind of construction. And you go through your morning classes. I think, if I remember right, there were three morning classes, and then you drill to lunch and back to the afternoon classes, and then in the evening, you had a study time that you had to devote to it. And of course, there was always the cleaning aspects that you. And on Saturday, there would be a review of just the whole. There were two classes at OCS at any one time, and they were separated by 8 weeks.
Okay.
So, I don't know, you might have 1,600 officer candidates. There were no women there, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you'd have a big parade review, and then if you hadn't received too many demerits and everything was ship-shaped, then at noon or 1 o'clock, you'd had liberty, and you'd go into... I was not married, so you'd grab a bus and go into Newport, and they had a locker club there where you changed into civilian clothes.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and, you know, go out and see Newport and party
right.
for the one night, and then more than likely you didn't have any money anyway, so you'd spend it all at some place to consume some of the local beverages, and then you'd stumble back to the base at some ungodly hour on Saturday night, and Sunday was pretty slack until about 6 o'clock, and then they started into study routines again. Liberty had expired and that sort of thing.
Right. Yes, sir.
But we started out with 900 and some officer candidates, and we wound up with 600 and some.
Yes, sir.
And it was predominantly academics. They've washed out because they couldn't pass the course. There were a few that dropped voluntarily. At that time, we had our term went over Christmas, and they gave us 2 weeks of what you call basket leave, where it didn't count against your record.
Okay.
You could just go wherever you wanted to for those 2 weeks. And there were four of us sharing a room, and I remember coming back, and there this one guy that was with us had gone home and said, he had a girlfriend, and she talked him into quitting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to this day, I never did understand that rationale. I wondered if he married her or not.
But right.
What the consequences were is if you got commissioned, it was a 3-year obligation. If you didn't, then you went in as an enlisted man for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So his decision was to go in as an enlisted for 2 years.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And there was another guy that was in our room that he washed out. And last time I saw him was we were going home on Christmas leave, and it was in Chicago train terminal. And when his leave was over, he had to go to Great Lakes to go through enlisted boot camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I never heard anything from him again. But there was a company just made up of enlisted that were in there. They were almost all E7s,
E6
and 7s, and they did really well. Those guys were pretty well handpicked, and they knew a lot about the Navy anyway. So I don't remember any of those guys failing out. But
right, but yes, sir.
The most we had one guy I know had 1 year of law school that washed out. So it was a tough time. And I'll be honest with you, I struggle academically a lot of the courses, but
right.
Heaved a sigh of relief when it finally got over.
And so,
it was a lot tougher than college.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the focus on academics. What, if you could, for just a moment, talk about what type of classes and what type of academic things you were learning.
Okay. I think the one that gave me the toughest is engineering.
Okay.
Just talking about the engineering plan on the ships, the steam cycle, and different aspects in machinery. I'm not really very mechanically inclined, and that gave me a fit. There's also operations section, which dealt with a maneuvering board, and maneuvering board has to do with relative motion.
Okay.
And I don't know whether you're familiar with what a maneuvering board is, but it's a circular device, and you use it to plot other ships' course and speed.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Navigation, was another one that gave a lot of people fits. You know, obviously had a lot of mess involved in it. And particularly when you got into the celestial aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we didn't do the actual taking of the sunlight, of the sun or the stars, but we were giving readings, and then we had to go into various publications to figure out our position.
Mm-hmm.
And so all those subjects were the ones that really were the big failures of our people. They also, of course, had stuff like seamanship and military justice.
Okay.
Oh, I'm trying to think of some of the others. Those are the ones that popped to mind.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Right offhand. I'm sure there was some others that just... those are the ones that were the toughest. Of course, mm-hmm. you did have to pass swimming courses.
Right.
And,
yes, sir.
By and large, most people didn't have any trouble with that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, was it any time during the training, was there any time where you guys actually went out on a ship, or was it all done there?
No, that's a good question. Yeah, we did go out in a ship.
Okay.
We went out on a destroyer in December out of Newport.
Okay.
I mean, it's the worst possible time you could go out out of Narragansett Bay.
All right.
In the dead of winter, into the North Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And they put us on... I've been seasick two times in my life, and that was one of them, Jason.
Right.
we got the whole tour of this ship.
Mm-hmm.
And are you familiar with sonar?
Vaguely.
Yeah, well, sonar is to detect underwater
mm-hmm.
Threats.
Right.
And the sonar sits at the bottom of the ship as far forward as you can go.
Okay.
So we got down there, and this is a hot, enclosed space.
Right.
As far down as you can go, and all you're hearing is this pinging
right.
of the sonar. And I'm telling you, I was fine until I went in that compartment. And from there on, I couldn't get out of there fast enough.
Oh, boy.
Or to the rail where I could loose it.
Uh-huh.
And the rest of my day out in training was involved in eating crackers and trying to get my stomach. But, yeah, we did get the indoctrination.
Okay,
yes.
Right.
One day out, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
We did. I think later they got some small craft up there that they could take them out on and get some more maneuvering experience. But all of our maneuver. Well, one other place we had a simulator.
Okay.
And you went into that simulator and you could give commands to. It was called a link trainer, and you could go in there and give. We worked problems with ships in there, and there was, if I remember correctly, it was designed. There was about. You got four or five different ships, and each one of them ship was in its own compartment and had three or four of us in there
mm-hmm.
giving commands and what have you, and you might have to form up in formation and use the maneuvering board and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that was an on-hand kind of training that didn't require you to go anyplace, and if you had a collision, it wasn't very important except in your grade.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, overall, from this training, how did you feel that you were adjusting to the military lifestyle, the Navy lifestyle?
Oh, I didn't have any problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was just fine. You're apprehensive, of course, after you leave there and where you're going for your first duty station.
Mm-hmm.
But I think mine was just a sigh of relief that I made it through successfully.
Right, yes, sir. All right. One more question about this.
Sure.
Could you talk a little bit about the instructors and your impressions of some of those guys?
They ran the gauntlet.
Okay.
You know, there were some that were the more technical guys. The more technical courses
mm-hmm.
were senior enlisted.
All
just
right.
Just because those were the hands-on guys.
Right. Yes, sir.
When you got to things like operations and things like that, you'd probably have a junior officer doing that kind of instruction. I'll be honest with you, the enlisted were a lot tougher on you, just because they knew what really they'd been working in this arena for years, and they knew what was supposed to happen and how it was supposed to be done.
Right.
And they were teaching it to you, and you better darn well learn it. I can remember particularly the engineering people. I don't remember an officer on the staff on the curriculum side at all. There was probably one that was in charge of the department.
Okay.
But as far as an instructor, with me, I don't remember anybody but a chief in there. And our company commander we had a chief and an officer, but it was predominantly run by the chief.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, any other particularly memorable moments or funny moments, anything like that from us?
I had one more thing that probably saved me up there.
Okay.
When you first went up there, they had us in an open bay barracks, the company I was with. And it was just a long row of what you see in every movie, a long row of bunks. And then at the end of of that room, there was a set of picnic tables.
Okay.
So everybody was down there studying at the picnic tables in mass. And when you get 30-some people in there, you're always going to have somebody that's saying something.
Right.
You know? I mean, you're supposed to be studying, but there's always somebody that's got a remark to make.
Right.
And I really think that if I had stayed down, if we'd stayed in that barracks, that I would never have made it. Because that's where I was having my trouble.
Right.
Well, fortunately for me, the heating system broke.
Okay.
I told you it was World War II vintage barracks.
Right.
System was antiquated. And the heating system broke, and they moved us to another barracks, which allowed 4 men to a room.
Mm-hmm.
And when they went down to the 4 men, then the distractions decreased proportionally.
Okay.
So you could start studying and not have all these distractions. And the 4 guys that I hooked up with were conscientious, although 2 of them never made it out. And the other guy was in the room. He and I graduated from high school together.
Okay.
And so he was quite an academic guy, so there wasn't going to be any distraction from him.
Right.
And so in the long run, that breaking of the heating system was instrumental in my career choice.
Right. Yes, sir.
You never know what little thing's going to happen.
That's for sure. All right. Well, once you were commissioned, did you receive your first assignment at that point, or was it more further training?
No. No, I had probably with about 4 weeks left.
Okay.
At OCS, I got orders.
Okay. All right. And what were those orders?
I went to the heavy cruiser Los Angeles.
Okay.
It was a World War II built heavy cruiser, built in, I think, in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
It was commissioned just before the end of World War II. It was a Baltimore class heavy cruiser, 8-inch guns and wood decks.
Mm-hmm.
You can equate it to a small battleship.
Okay.
The battleships, you know, had the 8 to 12-inch guns, and the cruisers started at 8-inch and went down to 6.
Okay.
And this was one of the big ones. It was put in the end of World War II, went over to China and Japan. I think they transferred some, picked up some POWs. They took them back to Japan from China.
Okay.
And did a couple other things. And then somewhere around, 47, 48, they decommissioned it.
Mm-hmm.
and Korea broke out, and they recommissioned it, and the ship went over and served two or three tours off Korea. They did shore bombardment and that sort of thing, and I know they got hit at least a couple times with what they call counter battery fire from the North Koreans.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
But it stayed in commission through, I left it in 62, and in 63 they decided to decommission it for good. Mm-hmm. And I think it was about another 10 years later than they actually reduced it, cut it up for scrap.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. What were your what was your assignment aboard the ship?
I had a unique assignment, actually. I went aboard as a deck division officer, seamanship, and my battle station was in the 8-inch turret.
Okay.
You won't find many of us around that fired the big guns, but I was in the number two turret. I was number two turret officer.
Okay.
Had the three 8-inch guns to fire, and had about 45 to 50 men going down from the lower powder deck to the upper powder deck to the shell deck, and then each gun had a separate compartment inside the turret.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you raid everybody in there, you were supposed to have about 50 men.
Oh, wow. Yes, sir.
And I could fire the gun from inside the turret, or I could put the controls on remote, and then they had a fire control director that could fire it from, had a station way up, almost the top part of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the guns, the weapons, projectiles weighed about 250 pounds, and they could fire 15 miles.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. what other types of duties did you have as deck division officer?
Well, I was a watchstander.
Okay.
And I did get qualified as officer of the deck underway, which was, to me, was a big achievement in a ship that size.
Yes, sir.
And let's see. I stood some watches in Combat Information Center. That pretty well took. I don't remember too many other classes. Of course, I was did military justice. I was at that time, the Navy did their own court martials on board the ship.
Mm-hmm.
That was later changed to where you couldn't do a summary. Are you familiar with the court martial system?
Just a little bit. Could you
talk
about
quick
it?
Summary for you? There's three types of court martials.
All right.
There's a general court, which is the one that can have you executed.
Mm-hmm.
There's a special, which has less power, but is still a group of officers, are enlisted and enlisted, I should say, that make judgment, and they have a prosecutor and a defense counsel. Just like you would in a civilian court. And then there's a summary court, which is a one-person court, one officer. The JAG people got the rules changed somewhere in the 70s to where you had to have a legal officer, qualified legal officer, be the prosecuting and the defense. Before that, it was the ship's officers did it.
Okay.
So I have been both the prosecutor and a defense counsel, and I've sat on special courts.
Okay. Yes, sir.
They changed the whole thing. I have some bad feelings about this. I'm sure you want me to go into it. But
well, you're welcome to if you'd like to.
Yeah, I would. I think the legal people screwed up the military justice as bad as they screw up the civilian court. You know,
right.
Before you could do it, you get it done, and either the fellow was guilty or he wasn't guilty. But now you've got to wait for. They had such a backlog finally that in the 70s, I sent a guy. I was the executive officer on a ship, and I sent a guy over to the brig in Norfolk, and he was in there a month, and they still hadn't done anything with him.
Huh, right.
Because they had such a backlog.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the lawyers screwed up the military as bad as they screwed up the Civilian Corps. that's my take on that.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, any memorable cases or issues regarding this from your time aboard the Los Angeles?
Time aboard Los Angeles was a great time. I had one kind of amusing incident.
Okay.
On that 8-inch turret.
All right.
Turret was, we were firing by just the number 2 turret, if I recall.
Mm-hmm.
May have been all of them, I don't know. But number 2 was firing. And what 8-inch guns predominantly do are shore bombardment. And we were on, there's a range out of San Clemente Island.
Okay.
Off the coast of California.
Right.
So we were out there firing at some targets that were on the hillside, mountainside there. It's a mountainous island there. And had the solutions all in for the target and what have you. And I think, if I remember right, it was being fired remotely because
mm-hmm.
the solutions were coming in from the fire control center.
Okay.
And the right and the center gun were pointed just fine. And just before they fired, my left gun went crazy.
Oh,
and
no.
It elevated to the maximum elevation and fired.
Okay.
Well, there were spotters, and they saw where the first two landed.
Mm-hmm.
They never saw the third round hit. And all these years later, I'm convinced that we fired completely over the island. And I can only speculate that there may have been a fishing boat or two on the other side of the island get a surprise when some shell landed out there in their fishing ground.
Right.
Never had any report of a sinking, so I don't think we hit any boat. But,
mm-hmm.
But anyway, it was an amusing time.
Right. Yes, sir.
And we also had on that ship a Regulus missile.
Okay.
It was one of the first missiles on a Navy ship. It was the Regulus 1. And it had to be... had to be guided.
Okay.
And it was what they call a surface-to-surface missile. In
uh-huh.
other words, you fired it from the surface, and it was had to go to another surface.
Okay.
An island or what have you. And we didn't fire a whole bunch. We fired off the end of the fantail, the end of the ship. But when you'd fire, and about 15 seconds later, you'd have two jets come racing past the ship. And they would guide it, literally
okay.
take command of the missile.
Oh, wow, okay.
And guide it to its destination. And that, you know, was one of the first missiles that the Navy had.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting to watch it work.
Right, yes, sir.
But there was always, the ship was so big, and it was, we carried an admiral, and it was... What you really think of is the Navy.
Okay.
That we were spit and polish, going to port, and you'd, particularly a foreign port, and you'd have all kinds of visitors, dignitaries come aboard. At times it got very tedious because you had to make sure that the cleanliness had to be above reproach.
Mm-hmm.
There was always somebody running around dinging on you. Because,
right.
Because I had one of the deck divisions, so we had a prominent part to play in all that, but the silhouette of the ship was what you think of when you think of a Navy ship.
Mm-hmm.
To me, anyway.
Right, yes, sir.
So it was a good time for me.
Mm-hmm.
It was we had one incident where they took us. We were sent to Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
Strictly for a change of command. They sent us from Long. We were out of Long Beach, California. And they sent us to Pearl Harbor just to be a platform for a 4-star admiral change of command.
Okay.
And that was an interesting time because they just the only people that got to bring their wives to this. It was done on the fantail, and the only people that can bring their wives were admirals and generals.
Mm-hmm.
And they, here I was. I think I was at JG by that time, and they brought these captains over in a Navy bus. Must have
okay.
been 30 of them. I couldn't imagine all these captains. I mean, they were like gods.
Right.
I mean, here they were. They were all in this Navy bus. So there's something wrong going on here.
Right. All right.
But those are some of the. We had a, it was just a good ship, and mm-hmm. we made one Westpac cruise on it, and that was kind of a highlight of the whole thing.
Right, yes, sir. Well, during the Westpac cruise, where all did you guys go? Did you make any port of calls?
Hong Kong. Spent a lot of time in Sasebo, Japan. Okay. That was our home port away from Long Beach.
Okay.
Kobe, Beppu, Yokohama.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple others that were up the rivers in Japan. Went to Subic Bay in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones we were supposed to go to Australia for the Coral Sea Festival. But it got canceled for some unknown reason.
Mm-hmm.
We spent a lot of time in Sasebo.
Okay. All right. What was your impression of Asia? That I guess that would be your first time in Asia. What was your impression of Asia?
I really liked it.
Okay.
I enjoyed it. It was the end of. World War II had been over about 15 years,
mm-hmm.
and you could, quite frankly, you could buy an awful lot of stuff in Japan
right.
for very little money, and I wasn't making a whole lot of money, but I had more than enough that I needed, and I bought all kinds of dishes and electronic stuff, and you could go over and party all night for very little.
Mm-hmm.
I came close to staying. I came close to extending to get shore duty
mm-hmm.
in Japan.
Right.
I put 2 years on the Los Angeles, and then I had a 3-year obligation, as I told you earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I was very seriously thinking of extending and just for shore duty in Japan. However, I elected for shore duty in Europe, so that's.
Mm-hmm.
But that was before I knew I was going to stay in.
Right.
But my impressions of, I love the Orient.
Mm-hmm.
I've been back a number of times.
Right.
On my own since I've retired.
Okay. Right.
And I think it's a great place.
Mm-hmm.
I have no reservations about going over there at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether I'd really like to go back to Japan. The prices have skyrocketed so much.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not terribly sure I could afford it.
Right, yes,
but,
sir.
But there are places that you certainly could afford.
Mm-hmm. Well, not to jump way too far ahead in
yeah.
this interview, but have you been back to Vietnam?
No.
Okay.
And I don't intend to.
Okay. All right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, again, another question, not to jump too far ahead,
sure.
but when did you make the decision to stay in the Navy, to extend?
I extended after I left Los Angeles
okay.
for shore duty in Europe.
Oh, okay.
And I was assigned to Naples, Italy, and I was still what they call reserve officer, Jason.
Mm-hmm.
And after I'd been there about a year or so, I decided to, I wanted to stay in the Navy. So then I had to put a letter in to augment.
Okay.
In other words, go regular Navy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's when I decided to stay.
Okay. Yes, sir. And so that was at the end of your time with the Los Angeles, and then you received shore duty at that point?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
The only reason I got shore duty was I gave them another year.
Oh, okay.
See, I had a 2-3 year obligation. I had completed 2, and I said, "Okay, I'll give you another year,
mm-hmm.
which would make 4, if you'll give me shore duty in Europe." And they did.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, one more question about your time aboard the Los Angeles.
Sure.
During your free time, if you had any, how would aboard ship? How would you spend it?
You mean when you're at sea?
Yes, sir.
Usually doing paperwork,
okay.
Reading, listening to music, movies in the wardroom,
mm-hmm.
AC/DC in the wardroom,
mm-hmm.
That sort of thing.
Right.
There's you know that you can't drink on Navy ship.
Right.
And so those are pretty much it. A lot of times you're just wind up doing your paper, catching up on the paperwork and reports and things like that that you've got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it seems like you're always inspecting, just making sure things are going okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there would be times when they would, like on Sunday, it was be like a big holiday, you know, and everybody maybe grab a mattress or something and go up and lay on an open area and try to get some sun.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, sir.
But, and that ship was built before all the air conditioning became prevalent. So,
right.
So, I mean, you had a windsock that was rigged on the ladders going down below, so you get some air down there. So, particularly a lot of the sailors just had to get up and get on deck to get some air.
Mm-hmm.
It was so hot in some of those places.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. So after this this first assignment, did you come to to enjoy life in the Navy? Did you?
I did. But you know, I really didn't think about staying in.
Okay.
Not seriously. I
mm-hmm.
thought, well, you know, I'll give them 4 years, and then I'll get out.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right.
And I 2 years in Naples was very nice, I got to tell you.
Yes, sir. You began that in 62?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Sometime, I think, like April, May, I went over there in 62.
All right. How did you get over there to Naples?
Oh, I flew.
Okay.
Yeah, I flew over out of McGuire Air Force Base. I actually took my car over. And I drove it to Bayonne, New Jersey, and they loaded it in the hold of the cargo ship there some fashion. It arrived about a month after I did.
Mm-hmm.
It
yes,
was,
sir.
I'm not sure it was a good decision, but I had made it. I just bought this car before this Westpac deployment, and it was a 62 Ford Fairlane metallic blue convertible,
mm-hmm.
white top.
Right.
Of course, the Italians drive Fiats. They drive these really small cars.
Right.
Mine looked like a tank inside that thing.
Right.
You know, it's really funny because you could bluff a lot of them because they didn't really, they're crazy drivers. I don't know whether you've ever been to Italy.
No, sir.
Or Naples in particular, but the Neapolitans have this death wish, I'm convinced, until the final minute,
uh-huh.
or second. And so you could go into an intersection with the big car and just look straight ahead and see them out of your peripheral vision, and they'll stop
because mm-hmm.
they don't think you see them. You get a much bigger,
right.
bigger vision there.
Right.
But I might add that on my way between duty stations, I got engaged.
Okay. Yes, sir.
And I subsequently came back, Jesus, a year later almost, not 10 months, came back 4 or 5 days before the wedding, got married, and we went brought her back to Italy for the last 15 months.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All
not
right.
your typical marriage.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, what was your assignment there in Naples?
When I first went over there, I was there. There's a NATO base there, Jason.
Okay.
It's a Allied Forces South.
All right.
And it's I was there as a I wasn't attached to NATO, but I was on their base, and I was in communications. It was a Navy communications
uh-huh.
unit that was there, and I was a watchstander for them, and I stood 8-hour watches. You'd stand, you know, 3 hour, I mean, three, 8 hours, like, I forgot, go in at 8 and get off at in the morning and get off at 4.
Okay.
And then somebody else came in at 4 and worked till midnight. Somebody else came in at midnight and worked till 8. And that was the kind of rotation. And then after you rotated through three watches each, 9 watches, then you got a couple of days off.
Mm-hmm.
And then just did it again and again.
Right.
So that was what I did first. And then after I got married, they changed my assignment and put me in charge of a message center.
Okay.
In a different location in Naples. And I worked basically for the commander of the Fleet Air in
mm-hmm.
Mediterranean. So it was more of an 8-to-5 job.
Right.
Much more suited to what I wanted to do. And the niceties of the location were much better.
Mm-hmm.
You had a little social life.
Right.
With this job. Plus I'd just gotten married.
Mm-hmm.
So that made it even better.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. How long did you remain here in Naples?
Naples, I came back in, I think it was July of 64.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. A little over 2 years.
Okay. Yes, sir.
And I got, came back on the best deal I ever had.
Mm.
I'm convinced. I came back on the Navy at the time was charter, would supplement U.S. flag ships. Civilian ships.
Okay.
And what I mean by supplement, they would buy certain passages, the number of passages.
Okay.
For people rotating.
Right.
So they, this was, but they did it by seniority at the same time in the summer, and I was the lieutenant at the time, which is a captain in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't very much rank, because most of the people rotating back were 06s and 05s.
Right.
And so, but I knew the guy that made the assignment.
Uh-huh.
I'd partied with him, he and his wife.
Right.
And so he got me on this ship. He and of course, my wife. And it was the SS Atlantic.
Okay.
They put my car in the hull of that ship.
Mm-hmm.
So my car was with me, and the trip over back took like 12 days.
Okay.
And we stopped in Genoa, Nice, Palma, Barcelona, Gibraltar,
mm-hmm.
Madeira Islands, and then came into New York City.
Oh, wow.
They paid for my whole fare. It was dead time, so it didn't count against my leave till I hit New York City.
Right.
The car was in the hole,
uh-huh.
So all I had to do was clear customs,
uh-huh.
Go down on the pier, get in my car, and start from Missouri.
Huh. Wow. Right.
And they gave me $5 a day to tip.
Uh-huh. Right.
So that was one of the best deals I've ever had in my entire life.
Mm, yes, sir. Certainly sounds like a pretty good deal. All right. Well, if we could back up for just a moment
sure.
In Italy, I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your impressions of Italy and of the Italians.
Well, first of all, you've got to divide Italy into two separate sections.
Right.
There's the Neapolitans in the south.
Okay.
And they come from a different breed.
Right.
And we went to Rome frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd tell them, well, they said, where do you live? And I said, Naples. And they just kind of shake their head and tell us they felt sorry for it. You know, that's all they kind of just, it's a whole another breed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of like going from Appalachia to New York City, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, but we got to travel quite a bit. I made an intent to do that, and we got into, while we were there, we got to Germany, up
mm-hmm.
to Garmisch and Berchtesgaden Gardens and King Ludwig's Palace and Heidelberg, and did, of course, Venice. Took one trip to Barcelona. And in Spain, in Lisbon,
mm-hmm.
So we saw and did quite a bit of stuff over there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
But my impressions of Italy, I loved it up to a point. You know, the rule of thumb then was it took you 3 months to adjust to the Neapolitans.
Okay.
Because they're actually very dirty. They're rude. and every other adjective that you can think of that might fall in those categories. And so people that come over there, you know, they just despise it. And you have it takes you about 3 months to adjust to them.
Right.
And once you do, you know, you just kind of fall into that mode. I thought.
Right.
I've been back to Italy, but I've never been to Naples since then.
Okay.
Been north.
Right. Yes, sir. Were the were they pro-American?
You know, yeah.
Okay.
There was no problem. While we were there, I remember Catherine's mother, much of my wife, wrote one day and said she'd seen some sort of a communist rally in Naples, and we never even heard of it.
Huh, right.
So, you know, the news media picked it up, but it wasn't anything significant in a city of that size.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, sir.
But I never had any problems.
All right. Well, any other memorable moments, funny moments, anything like that from your time there in Naples?
No, it was a good experience. The first apartment that I had when I first got married, I shared it with a guy who was a supply officer there, and then he agreed to move out after I got married. It had a balcony and it overlooked the whole Bay of Naples, and Vesuvius was in the background.
Oh, wow.
It was something you see in a postcard.
Right.
I mean, it was unreal. And then I guess about 6 or 7 months after we were in there, the guy that owned the apartment decided he wanted the apartment back sold the apartment, and the guy he sold it to wanted to live there.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to move to another spot. That was kind of a downer, but it... It worked all right. Now, the other thing I just flippantly kind of remember is you could take your liter wine bottle down around the corner to the local wine shop, and they would fill it for you from a big barrel for 50 cents.
Oh, right.
you go down there, these little old guys would be around there playing checkers or some other game, sitting in the – and it was typical of your what you would – vision of this kind of an environment, and you know, you come back with 2 liters of wine for a dollar.
Oh, wow.
And it was good wine.
Right. All right. Well, anything else from Italy before
moving on?
No, I think
that pretty well covers it.
Okay. All right. Well, once you returned to the U.S., what was next for you?
I got assigned to the Guam.
Okay.
Which was an LPH.
All right.
That's a helicopter carrier.
Okay. Yes,
you're
sir.
Fading away, Jason.
All right.
Okay, there you go.
Okay. All right. So a helicopter carrier then.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a new construction. It was being, you know, what I'm saying is it was built new. I was what they call a plank owner on it.
Okay.
We put it in commission. It was being built in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back there in, like I say, the summer of 64, and went to, it was going to be home ported in Norfolk, so I went to Norfolk, and I was part of a pre-commissioning detail, and I went through various schools in Norfolk, along with a lot of the other people that were assigned to ship, from September through December. And then we went to Philadelphia, and there was, of course, a lot of the ships, some of the ship's company was already there. And sometime in early January, I can't remember the date, we put the ship in commission.
Okay. Yes, sir.
And from there, she had a little bit more, they ran trials out of Philadelphia. Down the Chesapeake, and then we finally, the ship was accepted by the Navy fully.
Mm-hmm.
And then, see, I think it was sometime around March or April, we wound up going to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
Okay.
For shakedown training.
Right.
And that was a 6-month ordeal down in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
To get it all ship shape, and then we came back for an availability in Philadelphia for what they call post shakedown availability, and we spent another 2 months up there in Philadelphia, and then we took it back to Norfolk for good.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. What was your assignment here at Guam?
Yeah. I went aboard as the Assistant CIC Officer, Combat Information Center Officer.
Okay.
And after, I don't know, a year or so, I became the Gunnery Officer.
Okay.
Which was more of my liking.
Mm-hmm.
But that's basically what I did. Stood watches in Combat Information Center initially, and then I finally got up to the bridge and stood watches from on the bridge.
Yes, sir. All right. Now, at this point, had you extended again?
No, I was a regular officer.
Right. So,
I got augmented when I was in Naples.
Right.
So
okay.
From that point on, there's no extensions. If you wanted to get out, you'd have to write a letter and request to revert back to reserve and be released from active duty.
Right, okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, as gunnery officer, could you talk a little bit about that and what you would do?
Well, it was not a huge job. We had two 5-inch 50, 3-inch 50 mounts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my responsibility as gunnery officer, that and helping the... I worked for the first lieutenant, and the first lieutenant on a Navy ship is in charge of the deck,
okay.
All the deck fittings and things like that. And that's who I reported to. But I enjoyed that because I could get out more in the open air.
Mm-hmm.
CIC's enclosed.
Right.
And there were a number of other officers in the CIC, and I just... The gunnery was a... To me, it was a bit better job.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
so
sir.
You know, you fired a few rounds. One of the more interesting things was down in the Netherlands and Antilles. We made two deployments, Jason,
okay.
On that ship while I was on. Both of them were to the Caribbean.
Okay.
And we visited some of the islands down there, obviously, and one of them was Carousel, which is in the Netherlands Antilles.
Okay.
And this was before Aruba became the big spot to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Dutch, and so we exchanged saluting battery fire with them. And so we steamed off the coast of the city down there, and I can't remember what the name of the major city was. But anyway, we fired the 21 gun, I think it was, salute. They fired back, you know, alternate things.
Mm-hmm.
The shell is a really small shell, and we had a saluting battery that fired it.
Okay.
And after it was all over, I took two of those shells, and I didn't know what the heck I was going to do with them. And then now I've made lamps out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Still use them.
Right.
Still
have them
in my bedroom.
All right.
If you've never... But Carousel is one of the most interesting ports I've ever been in because they have a breakwater that goes through. It's a big oil refinery place, and they had this breakwater that, like a bridge, it actually opens up,
mm-hmm.
and it's to keep the sea water out in mass. But they open it for ships, and you once they get it, they open this bridge. Think of a bridge as being in the water,
okay.
and swinging out,
okay.
and opening up this channel.
Huh.
And we steamed right down their main street, and with a helicopter, with a carrier, you know, you're looking over the side. You're looking right down on the street.
Huh. Interesting.
And
huh.
As soon as we were in, then they closed the gate.
Right.
and they bring in big tankers for their oil refineries there.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting place.
Huh. Yes, sir.
Never been back, but I would like to someday.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that's, we carried, when we deployed, when we got fully manned, there were 600 people in the crew.
Okay.
It was full time. And they get, when we deployed, we brought the Marines on board, and they carried a battalion landing team, which is 1,800 Marines,
mm-hmm.
and they brought an air squadron on board, which they carried 26 helicopters.
Okay.
And the mission of the ship was what they call vertical envelopment. You remember during World War II and earlier, they had landing craft that
right.
would hit the beaches and land.
Yes, sir.
So the concept in vertical envelopment was why they were hitting the beach and landing there. There would be another contingency of Marines flying over the beach, going behind the bad guys,
right.
and then pinching them between the water and themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would go down there and run various exercises, and they would offload. But when they weren't on board, it was almost like a ghost ship.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they were on, it was just like mayhem.
Right.
So you take your pick, whichever one you wanted.
Right.
But when we were in port in the States, it was just the ship's company.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. How many deployments did you make?
We made two.
Two? Okay.
2 4-month deployments. I spent 2 back-to-back Christmases in San Juan.
Mm-hmm.
Right. First 2 Super Bowls.
Right. Was this just an exercise, or was something actually going on?
Well, it was ships normally deploy.
Okay.
You know, whether there's a, but the second time we went down there, we got involved in a little bit more of an exercise, and they were having a war over the Dominican Republic.
Okay.
And we were actually about 20 miles off the coast, ready to land the troops.
Mm-hmm.
And it was put down, but it was listed as a contingency, and we got an Armed Forces Expeditionary Medal out of it for being down there.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, did you guys go anywhere else? Anywhere else? Any cruises or anything like
that? No, just those two.
Okay.
Like I say, we hit various islands like St. Thomas,
right.
St. Croix, Barbados, but we never went anyplace else. But we were gone a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, at sea and that sort of thing. I think because the ship was in Philadelphia for so long, and then we were gone down there. I think mm-hmm. And then, of course, when you're in port, you stay in duty.
Right.
So yes, every third day, you've got to watch. I think I figured out 1 year I was home 25 days.
Mm. Wow. Right.
Actually off the ship.
Home. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. As I was researching for your interview, I was reading a little bit about the ship's history, and I noticed that said that they were involved in some of the astronaut recoveries from Gemini missions. Were
God,
you?
God, how did I miss that? Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, we picked up, I think it was Gemini 11.
Okay.
I was working on the deck force at the time, with the gunnery, I mean, and so we went out into we were out in the Caribbean, and there was 2 ships involved. I think it was the other one was the Lexington, and they were in the Pacific.
Okay.
And we were in the Atlantic, and as the mission developed, they could abort it at any time. In other words, they would abort in the Atlantic or the Pacific.
Right.
So when they flew over us, and kept on going, we would be given a new set of coordinates to go to.
Okay.
And we didn't know whether, you know, they were going to abort when they go over the Pacific. And so we really wanted to pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I'm sure the Lexington wanted to pick them up in the Pacific.
Right.
And, you know, every time they'd fly over the Lexington, you could hear a cheer go up because we might be the ones to get them.
Right.
And sure enough, we got them.
Oh, wow. Right.
Yes, and, they came down. I was down on the hangar deck,
uh-huh.
and I was supposedly in charge of trying to make sure that the capsule got picked up and right and everything like that, although I had minimal to do with it. But they were talking to the guys on the bridge. They were, our coordinates were so close to where the capsule went down that the ship had to back down.
Huh, wow.
Or it would have landed on the flight deck. It was that close.
Wow.
I mean, when it went down, I could see it. It was off right off the hangar deck, off the elevator. And it probably wasn't 300 or 400 yards.
Hmm.
And as soon as it hit, well, I think before it hit, the helicopter was airborne, and they had, we had two or three Navy SEALs.
Right.
And they jumped in and put a flotation collar around it.
Uh-huh.
Got the two astronauts out and brought them back to the ship. And then we got the capsule over to the side and hoisted it aboard.
Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
And it was Conrad and Cooper were the two astronauts.
Okay.
And that afternoon they had a big all hands muster down on a flight deck and on a hangar deck, and they spoke, and I think they enlisted a couple guys. And then, interesting enough, I got to meet them on the bridge that night.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the 20 to 24 watch, and they came up there.
Huh, yes, sir.
And both of them were really small men.
Okay.
Obviously, I guess trying to fit in that capsule,
right,
it had to be short of stature. And so, and one other interesting thing was they took some samples from them, whatever, blood and other things.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to get those back to Cape Canaveral as quickly as they could.
Right.
So I guess they used one of our weather balloons, and they tied the balloon, they tied this long string on the balloon.
Huh.
And we were far enough out that the helicopter couldn't make it.
Right.
So they put the samples in some sort of a container that was resting on the flight deck.
Okay.
And I have no idea how high that balloon line went, but it had to go up a considerable way. And an Air Force fixed wing came over and picked that thing up.
Huh.
Flew right over the top of our flight deck and snatched it.
Right. Yes, sir.
And reeled it in and flew back to Cape Canaveral.
Huh. Yes, sir.
That afternoon. I remember watching the thing. I was amazed. I could, because this big old lumbering Air Force thing. I said, what the heck are they doing? And the next thing I know, they snatched this thing off. And then the next morning, the two astronauts heloed over off the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went on back to Norfolk.
Right. Yes, sir.
The capsule stayed on board the ship, and it was offloaded in Norfolk.
Okay.
I'm sure it was, and then probably taken to Cape Canaveral.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The truck.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Any other memorable moments aboard the Guam?
You're fading again.
I'm sorry. Any other memorable moments aboard the Guam?
I can't think of any right off the top.
Okay. All right. And
Jason, I'm losing you.
Okay. Yes, sir. Can you hear me now?
No.
Uh-oh. Let me pause real quick. All right. How long were you aboard the Guam?
Almost 2.5 years.
Okay, so that would have been
when you got right down to it, I was there from September of 64 to 67, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, probably April or May.
Mm-hmm.
In 67.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, of course, during this time, things were beginning to heat up in Vietnam.
Right.
Were you paying attention? Were you guys getting much news about what was going on in Vietnam?
By that time, my best friend had been killed in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, he was in the riverboats, and he got killed in 64, I guess.
Okay.
So, yeah, I knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Had you formed much of an opinion on the war at that point?
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was kind of a remote thing, what you read about in the paper, what you saw happening on television.
Right.
But it was like it's another world away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I had my own stuff to worry about.
Right.
What I was doing there. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't... I had a family by that time, or hoped to have a family very soon, and,
mm-hmm.
and I really wasn't that intent on it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Except for Dale getting killed, and there was nothing I could do about it at that stage. So.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Did you think that you would eventually be going? Did you think that was a possibility?
I had no idea.
Uh-huh.
I'll be honest with you, I had no idea.
Right. Right. Yes, sir.
I did not volunteer, if that's your question.
Okay. All right. Yes, sir. Okay. Well, once you, getting back to the timeline, I guess, once you finished up your time on the Guam, what was your next assignment at that point?
I went to the Nitro, which is an ammunition ship.
Okay.
The Nitro was going through a long overhaul. They decommissioned the ship, and were putting on some new transfer equipment, and they had been decommissioned for about a year and a half, so most of the original crew at that time was gone. There was about 40 people left. They were going through the conversion in Baltimore, and I was put in charge of what they call a pre-commissioning group in Norfolk.
Okay.
So I had 100 or so sailors and officers down there that I was in charge of, making sure they got through their training, they got to the right schools. There probably was some manuals that I was working on trying to update them.
Mm-hmm.
I had an administrative staff and a small office there at the Fleet Training Center in Norfolk.
Okay.
And we stayed there for about 3 or 4 months in this training mode. And it was in 67, and I wanted to say it was late summer, maybe midsummer. Anyway, that I finally joined the ship and just took the whole crew and went up to Baltimore.
Okay.
And we put the ship back in commission. Baltimore kind of did a modified thing that we'd done on the Guam, except this obviously wasn't new construction.
Mm-hmm.
And went down to Guantanamo for training, just like we'd done with the Guam, and then came back. Our home port was Davisville, Rhode Island.
Okay.
Which was up the river, if you will, from Newport, Rhode Island. It was at, when you say ammunition ship, Jason, everybody gets terrified, and they park you as far away from everything as they possibly can.
Right.
So we were on a CB base up there. At the time, there was a CB base at Davisville.
Okay.
And there was also a Quonset Naval Air Station over on that side, but there was a merchant pier that they were shipping a lot of stuff out for Vietnam.
It
would come through that Davisville terminal. And we were the only ship that was Navy ship that was up there.
Mm-hmm.
But you go through past Newport and go around a couple of those islands in Narragansett Bay and then go on up to Davisville.
Okay.
South of Providence. So I was on there for 2 years. I went aboard as the operations officer.
Okay.
And the navigator. I had two jobs.
Yes, sir.
And it's about 16 or 17 officers and 250 enlisted. It was a nice ship. It was a good experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. let's see. Where did you guys go?
Well, our deployment was to the Mediterranean.
Okay, to the all right.
And I made one full deployment to the Med.
Uh-huh.
And then I was on a second deployment when I got detached to go to Vietnam.
Okay.
I think we left on the second deployment in like July, and I had to be in Coronado, California in September. So I was there for about a month, I guess.
Okay. All right. That was July of 69?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. before moving on to getting that assignment to Vietnam, any memorable moments, anything we should mention from the Nitro?
I'm not sure anything good.
Okay.
We had some bad experiences down in Gitmo, which is kind of funny in retrospect.
Okay.
But we crashed into a pier.
Oh, no.
And dropped the anchor on the pier on one occasion. And a couple days later, we actually went aground, and you could see the perimeter fence of Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to get a couple tugs out to pull us off.
Mm-hmm.
And it was part of our training, and people got instructions crossways, and so we had a little bit bad reputation.
All right.
So anyway, it was I was in there, three or four years later on another ship, and they'd never repaired the pier. Still had a big pie shape out of it.
Right.
But you should have seen the ship that went in there. I said, no, I was on it.
Right.
So, but trying to think if there was anything really significant that, on the deployments, was over. We left in July, I think it was, and came back in January 68. To January of 69.
Mm-hmm.
It hit the normal ports in Europe. We spent a lot of time in Malta.
Okay.
There's a little town south of Valletta called Marsalox, and we spent quite a bit of time there. We were in Naples and Athens and Villa France.
Okay.
Some of the ones that they come to mind.
Right. Yes, sir.
I guess that was the last time I was in Naples.
Okay. Right. Yes, sir.
All right. But that's pretty much it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. All right. See, but you were actually on a deployment when you received your orders for Vietnam.
Yep, I was on deployment. I had to catch a flight back to we must have been in Malta.
Okay.
And on that second trip, and I caught a flight to Rota, Spain. And
all
then
right.
Another military flight back to the States. I don't even remember where we came in the States.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was Norfolk or McGuire. But, and then I, from there, I made my way back to Rhode Island. And by that time, had one son who was 6 months old, I guess.
Okay.
No, he wasn't 6 months old. Oh, was he? Yeah, he might have been six.
Okay.
He was a year old.
Okay.
What am I thinking about? He was a year old, and my wife was pregnant.
Oh, wow. Yes, sir. All right.
So we left there, and drove essentially across country. We drove to Missouri and spent a short time here with our families.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to counterinsurgency school in Coronado, and she said, they said in the instructions, don't bring your families. And she says, I'm going to go. I don't care. She said,
right.
You're going to Vietnam for a year, and I'm going to I'm not going to make it a 16-month deployment.
Right.
So she wound up going with me out to California.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, if you could, what was your initial reaction to receiving the assignment to Vietnam? What was your reaction to that?
Well, I guess it was kind of shock.
Mm-hmm.
I actually can remember getting the orders.
Uh-huh.
And we were, the ship was in Earl, New Jersey. There's a big ammunition depot there.
Mm-hmm.
And I received my orders, and I'm thinking, holy smokes.
Mm-hmm.
This is not going to be much fun.
Right.
So I wasn't so worked up about the orders as I was the separation period.
Right, sure.
You know, that was the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. What was your wife's reaction to...
Well, I think it was kind of the same thing.
Okay.
You know, what's it going to entail and, you know, how much danger is it where you're going and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, how much time did you actually have off before you had to report to Coronado?
You know, I think it was maybe 2 weeks.
Okay.
I think I cranked it in there that... When I built my itinerary,
mm-hmm.
to get out there, that was going to take 2 weeks, and so that's why I wound up flying and going right on out.
Okay,
I think I had my own options on it. But that's what I did.
Okay, yes, sir. All right. You said it was to counterinsurgency school?
Yes.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about that training and the purpose of it and what the training was like for you?
Sure. It was really an interesting time in my life. It was 13 weeks.
Okay.
And there was, as I recall, about 60 men that were in the school, about half officers and half enlisted. And... the enlisted were all senior petty officers of some sort. I was the third senior officer. I was a lieutenant commander by then. And our senior officer was a Naval Academy graduate. He was also a lieutenant commander.
Okay.
And then there was two other lieutenant commanders. One was a Mustang who kind of came up from the ranks, and he was senior to me. And then there was one other one that was junior to me. And the training took place in Coronado, which is the amphib base there in San Diego.
Okay.
They had, we went through several classrooms. It's, like I say, 13 weeks. It seemed like there was 4 weeks, it seemed like, that were devoted to language, that we working on the Vietnamese language. I may have some of this timing. It may be more than 4 weeks.
Okay.
But we devoted at least 4 weeks, and it may have been six, to the Vietnamese language.
Right.
And I knew enough to get by. To jump ahead a minute, I never really used it.
Okay.
Because everybody that I associated with basically spoke English from years of dealing with other people.
Okay.
And so... but it was good to know, and I'm sure a lot of them did use it.
Right.
And then we spent about four weeks on general indoctrination, on tactics, on the culture of the Vietnamese.
Okay.
What you can expect, what you should do. Don't get embarrassed if somebody comes up and holds your hand,
mm-hmm.
because that's an acceptable practice there.
Right.
You know, there were just a lot of little things that mounted to whether you're going to offend the people or not.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, if you're an advisor, you don't want to offend anybody if you're going to have to work with them.
Right.
We did quite a bit of PT. We ran in boots.
Mm-hmm.
We formed up into two companies, and I was in charge of one of the companies, and the other lieutenant commander was junior to me, had the other one, and the two senior ones became the CO and the XO of the organization.
Okay.
So we did, like I say, a lot of PT, a lot of running. We went We had an obstacle course that we ran a few times that was sort of a junior one. They let us on the, interesting side note, they let us on the big one time, the one that the SEALs train on.
Right.
And I tell you, I did some of it, but there was some of it I wasn't having any part of.
Mm-hmm.
They went to these high wires and things like that and balance beams that were way off the ground. And I said, there's no way I'll fall off that thing and break my neck.
Right.
I have a very good appreciation for SEALs. I think they're a great bunch of guys, I tell you. But, boy, because some of the things they have to go through are just nuts to get there. But,
sir.
You got an interesting perspective on just touring part of their training course. And, of course, their training base is there. So every now and then you'd see those guys out there running with telephone poles on their shoulders.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, sir.
We spent 3 weeks gone. We spent 1 week in Pendleton in a weapons familiarization course where we went up there and basically fired all the weapons that you could, 50 calibers and Laws and M16s and that sort of thing. And we did another week up there where we took part in war games, and we were just out there, and they would ambush us, and we would set up tactics trying to avoid ambushes, and we would go in the perimeter for the night, and they would had loudspeakers and broadcasting to us that, here you are in Vietnam, and your wives and girlfriends are back home with the people, the draft dodgers.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And anything they could to get to you.
Right.
The culmination of the trip was on a Friday or Thursday night was an all-night hike, and this goes on with every training group that goes through it, but you got some coordinates of where the bad guys' camp was, which were the trainers.
Okay.
And so you basically marched all night, and the guy that was in charge of it and myself crawled up and found the camp, because I remember he said, "Do you want to go with me?" I said, "Sure." And so we outlined where the attack was going to be and the timing, and then we deployed all the troops around the around the thing. And at first light, and we had a time set for it, and we jumped in there and killed them all, so to speak.
Right.
But it was a good battle problem for us, because you were marching in the dark and using compass coordinates and that sort of thing to get to where you're going.
Right. Yes, sir.
See, I shift gears here. You go from the Navy to an entirely different environment.
Right.
And that's where you just change your whole mindset on everything.
Mm-hmm.
The last week was the survival week,
which
was probably the most interesting of the whole group. The first part of it, they started in San Diego, and you slept on the beach. I remember you're supposed to catch fish, and I've never fished and never caught anything, and I wound up eating raw snails off the seawall, which were not too bad in retrospect. I didn't die or anything. So.
Right, yes, sir.
And then they took us up into the mountains where the course is, and it was a really dry, hot fall, and you there wasn't anything up there to eat. So you're wound up eating acorns and things like that. You're supposed to go out and catch rabbits and things like that, and the rabbit population had all diminished by then.
Right.
You couldn't find, I don't know if anybody caught anything. And the last, on a Thursday night, they gave us, they brought this big piece of meat in and cooked it in a pot stew. And I didn't have anything to eat, basically, for the week. And, of course, the first thing I did was get diarrhea.
Mm-hmm.
And you may not even want to hear this story, but anyway, one of the things we learned in training, Jason, was that if you eat charcoal,
okay,
it will stop the diarrhea.
Okay.
We had a fire that night in the the things had died down. I just went over where the and just ate some of that charcoal.
Uh-huh.
And it works.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
If you ever get in that situation, it does work.
Okay.
The next morning, there's supposed to be the final start of the final part of it, and that's the capture and that sort of thing in the prison. And they decided that they said, well, we're going to put you in three trucks, and each one's going to leave separately, and we're going to dump you out, and then you've got to evade the captors. Well, I guess they decided because of the fire hazard, they weren't going to let us evade, and they weren't going to tell us about it.
Hmm.
So anyway, the truck I was in was the second one to leave. There was a bit of an interval. And we've been gone, I don't know, five minutes maybe, and all of a sudden shots went around us,
mm-hmm.
and the truck stopped, and it was guys dressed up in North Vietnamese uniforms.
Okay.
They told us to get out, line up. So they said, who's the senior guy here? And I looked around, you know who was the senior guy?
That's
me.
Right.
So first they did, they hit me in the... And then they want to know where I'd come from, where to ship.
Uh-huh.
And I told them nothing. So to make a long story a little shorter, I got waterboarded.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredibly terrifying experience, I got to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
They put me on a board, inverted board.
Right.
And they poured water. They took a towel, a T-shirt-like thing. Put that over my face and poured water.
Okay.
You can't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time they did it, I just broke out. I just broke the bonds of the sport. And then they put me back down because you're not supposed to resist them. That's all part of the training.
Right.
You're supposed to go. And, you know, after they did that about four or five times, I told them where I came from.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you're just, these nut guys are going to drown me. I can't breathe.
Right.
Anyway, they put us back in the truck, took us into the camp, and first thing they did, of course, was take my glasses away, and they take your watch,
mm-hmm.
so you can't see, and you don't have any idea what time it is.
Right.
And they put a mask over your head, sack.
Okay.
March you into the camp, make you crawl into the camp, actually. So basically, I spent most of that day getting beat up, spent some time in a tiger cage.
Yes, sir.
Then I got interrogated, and you're supposed to try to escape, but I knew there was not going to be any escaping for me because I couldn't see where I was going.
Right.
And we had one black guy who was an E5, and that guy escaped three times.
Oh, wow. Right.
He just had him going nuts. But... in the middle of the afternoon, we were moving rocks from one side of the compound to the other.
Okay.
And they said, okay, who's the senior? They wanted to see the senior officer. Well, I knew I was the third senior. I hadn't seen the other two guys, but I knew I was the third senior, and everybody seemed to be there.
Right.
But I didn't pay any attention to him.
Right.
And after about the third or fourth time they told me that, I said, maybe I better go over there.
Uh-huh.
So I walked over and I said, I think I'm the senior guy here. And he hit me, of course.
Uh-huh.
That was their first. It's an open palm hit.
Right.
And I don't know what he told me. But anyway, you know, they probably took me in for interrogation or something. But I didn't know what happened to the other two guys.
Uh-huh.
And then they assembled us about, it was dark. And the guy that was our senior officer in this group, was the only way I can describe him is he had stars written on his shoulder. I mean, he was an outstanding officer, lieutenant commander, very good looking, personable, big guy, definitely going to be an admiral.
Uh-huh.
And they brought him out there, and he started wrestling with me. He said, I told you I quit. I told you I quit.
Wow.
He had quit the program.
Wow.
He told him he wasn't going to go through any more of that getting beat up and put in a cage or anything else.
Uh-huh.
And he had apparently quit that morning And since they knew the second senior guy was a good friend of his, they pulled him in to try to talk him into changing his mind.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, I'd been in charge and hadn't even known it.
Right.
And the guy walked off the stage.
Oh, wow.
He says, I quit. He says, I'm not doing this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so to jump that problem ahead just a skosh, he said, they sent him home on leave. He didn't go with us to Vietnam.
Huh.
And I heard later that they tried to get him through two more courses.
Right.
Classes, and he never did make it.
Oh, wow.
And often wondered what happened to him, whether that ended his career, essentially,
mm-hmm.
or whether it had any impact at all.
Mm-hmm.
But he never, as far as I know, he never made it to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, sir.
But anyway, we finished. And then we wound up going home, and I left right away. We had to catch a flight out of Travis Air Force Base in California in 4 or 5 days.
Okay.
And my wife had delivered.
Oh, wow.
Out there. So we had a 1-month-old would have been a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And to take back. And we drove from San Diego to, I got as far as Springfield, Missouri, which is about 200 miles west of here.
Okay.
And my family met us, and I couldn't go any further. I didn't have any more time. And so I got on a plane here,
mm-hmm.
and or in Springfield, and flew to Travis, and my family drove my wife and family back to Missouri.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So I caught a flight and went to at Travis, joined up with the rest of the people,
mm-hmm.
and flew from there to Saigon.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, before we actually get into to the beginning of your tour in Vietnam, if we could back up for just a moment, I have a few more questions about the counterinsurgency program, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
Okay. All right. Was there any sort of riverine-type training, anything like that? Or was
no.
It? Okay.
No, the riverine training went on up at Vallejo.
Ah, okay.
Ours was not riverine.
Okay.
In fact, initially there were no. I don't think there was anybody in our group that was destined to go into riverines. They were different kinds of advisors.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them were coastal group advisors, which were the junk force.
Okay. Yes, sir.
But I don't recall anybody that was destined for riverine
mm-hmm.
in their orders.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, how about the instructors there at the counterinsurgency? Were these guys who had already been to Vietnam?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Overall, did you feel that the training prepared you, I guess, as good as it could?
I think it did. It was the most interesting Navy school I ever went to.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. And I think it got us started as much as we could, because, like I say, we were going to a variety of jobs,
mm-hmm.
so it had to encompass, you know, there were guys going to staff jobs and things of this nature, but they were going to interface with the Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
so they had to be aware of what the customs were and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the guys I never saw again after I got in country.
Yes,
I only
sir.
Remember one or two that I ever saw again.
Okay.
And one was a guy who worked in Saigon, and I think he had a desk job. And but another fellow was up at Coastal Group 11, which was just south of the DMZ.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, was there anything that the training did not cover, but you, looking back in retrospect, you wish it would have?
That's an interesting question. I never even thought of that.
Okay.
You know, I really can't think of an example of what they could have missed. You know, if from my own standpoint, in retrospect, I wish they'd had some more stuff on Riverines, but that wouldn't have been appropriate for the people that were going through it.
Right.
And they already had that going at another location.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. All right. Well, Ian, before actually getting into Vietnam, this is probably, if you don't mind, probably a good place to go ahead and stop for today. We're getting close to the two-hour time limit. So if you don't mind, we'll go ahead and take a break for today.
Okay.
This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. John Holland. Today is July 30th, 2010, and this is interview session number two. Okay, last time when we left off, you were just about to begin your tour of duty in Vietnam.
Right, and you're starting to fade already.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. Hopefully that won't be too much of a problem today.
We'll deal with it if it is.
All right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, why don't we begin then? If you tell me about the trip over. First of all, how did you get to Vietnam?
You mean transportation?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, the group that we went through counterinsurgency with all took the same flight out of Travis Air Force Base outside of San Francisco. So
okay.
We met there, and flew from there. A couple stops. I think we had one in Pearl and one in Guam. I was thinking later there was an amusing anecdote that when we there was three of us in the seat and one of the guys had a fifth of whiskey.
Okay.
And I said, Harvey, we get in trouble smuggling that whiskey on board. He said, what are they going to do to us? Send us to Vietnam? So we, on the trip over, we polished that thing off.
Right.
It was a Braniff charter.
Okay.
They had, it was a civilian manned flight, and it was very nice. Just across, of course, the flight across the Pacific is always long, so.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, sir. All right. What was your rank at this time?
I was Lieutenant Commander.
Lieutenant Commander. Okay. All right. And where did you come into country?
Saigon.
At Saigon. Okay. Mm-hmm. At Tonsonut?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And upon stepping off the plane, what was your first impression of Vietnam?
Your first impression is that you think you're going to get machine gunned as soon as you step down off the plane. You know, I had this. I didn't really know what to expect, and they put us on a bus, and the bus had, wire screens across the window, I guess to keep people from throwing grenades in the bus, and I remember the bus driver crawling underneath it, inspecting it. I'm not sure in retrospect that he wasn't doing that for a bit of show,
right?
But it was also new. That you all of a sudden you're flying into a combat environment, and it is a cultural shock.
Right,
there's no question about it.
Yes, sir. All right. Do you remember the exact date? Do you remember that?
Oh no, it was late November.
Okay.
One other thing on the flight over that was noteworthy. I missed Thanksgiving Day that year.
Oh, yes, sir.
We left the day before, and if you know when you cross the international date line,
right,
you advance a date.
Right.
And when we landed, it was the day after Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I was in a group a few years ago, the question was, what was the most noteworthy Thanksgiving you ever experienced? And mine was the one I didn't have.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Let's see. Where? What sort of in-processing did you have?
You know, what I remember is they took us to a barracks, and they had a section for officers, and then the rest of it was for enlisted, and I spent, I think, one night there. It seems like it, and I don't remember too much about it. There was a club, an officer's club close by, and we went over there, and then seemed like the next day I got relocated to a BOQ in Saigon, and we checked in with, I checked in with the Naval Advisory Group headquarters in Saigon, and you know, they processed the orders and everything, and then made arrangements for my further transfer.
So it was at that point you found out exactly what unit you would be going to?
I had orders all the time.
Okay.
And I knew where I was supposed to go.
Right. All right. Oh, one other question about arriving. Did you come in, was it at night when you came in?
Daytime.
It was in the daytime. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, once you got your, checked in with the Naval Advisory Group, you said they organized further transportation. Where were you going to?
To Da Nang.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And how did you get there?
Well, I flew. It was a military aircraft. I do remember, though, that the flight, I went to Tanzanute again, and the flight was postponed and postponed for mechanical reasons, and finally that day they canceled it. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have any place to go, and I wound up sleeping on the loading platform outside the air terminal there at Tanzanute.
Right.
I had a valve pack and a duffel, and I just slept on that, and then whatever mechanical problems they encountered, they fixed it, and I flew up the next day.
Mm-hmm. All right. So is that where you were going to be based out of?
Right.
Da Nang?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, my orders were to the Coastal Surveillance Center.
Okay.
As the officer in charge.
All right. Okay. Well, before getting into your actual duties there, could you talk a little bit about, about Da Nang and your impressions of it and your quarters there?
Well, Da Nang was a big, sprawling metropolis there was a lot of military and Navy base. There was a Navy support activities where I was quartered.
Okay.
And got a room at the BOQ. It was a really nice facility. Of course, the Air Force was there. They had their base, and it was the Marine Corps headquarters for I Corps.
Okay.
So there was a lot of stuff going on.
Right. Yes, sir.
And the base where I was, I guess it was a Vietnamese Navy installation.
Okay.
Which was, it would seem like it was about a 10-minute jeep ride from the support activity.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, upon arrival there, what was your first impression of the Coastal Surveillance Group and of the guys that you were working with? You don't have to go into specific names if you would prefer not to, but if you could talk a little bit about the unit itself.
Well, what the mission was?
Yes, sir, that, and also, if you could, some of the personalities. Again, you don't have to get into names, but something like that. Yes, sir.
Well, the interesting part was that when I got there, the Naval Surveillance Center's responsibility was to prevent interdiction of I Corps by the North Vietnamese with supplies. What they would do is bring ships down the coast and then land them at night in a clandestine manner and supply the NVA and the Viet Cong with ammunition, supplies, that sort of thing. And our job was to monitor. We had ships that were off the coast. And that was the Navy ships and Coast Guard ships. And we were the coordinating the tracking of any suspicious ships that would be out there and could vector any of our ships, the friendlies or aircraft, to investigate and board if necessary. The people there were competent. I my thing is I didn't work there very long.
Okay.
When I checked in, the senior Navy advisor for I Corps was a full commander, and he was stationed, as I recall, in the same compound. I don't remember whether he's in the same building or not, but it was in the same compound. And I really reported to him.
Okay.
But as soon as I checked in, I was informed that the officer that I had orders to replace was in the river boats. Mm-hmm. And they had created this riverine operation, and he took over the operation. And apparently, I don't know whether Washington didn't know this or not, but when they cut the orders, it was for the officer in charge of the Coastal Surveillance Center, but it turned out I got an entirely different assignment.
Ah, yes, sir. All right. So did you spend any time then in the Coastal Surveillance Group before going out on the boats there?
I spent a month.
A month, okay.
I went to the boats on Christmas Day of 69.
Okay. All right. Well, during that month time period, what could you talk a little bit about what you were doing during that first month there?
You know, I'll be honest with you, I don't remember much about that month.
Sure.
It was a very boring job.
Okay.
And I can't even, I guess the other guy, we had a month turnover there of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really remember ever having much of a turnover at all with him. You know, I took over the Coastal Surveillance Center and ran it. And then when I left, the second in command, I don't even remember who that was, took it over. At the time, you know, I was apprehensive about going into the riverboats.
Sure.
Because you know, you read so much about the action that they were doing. At the same time, what I was doing was pretty boring.
Mm-hmm.
And I hated to think I was going to spend a year doing this kind of work.
Right.
So I had mixed emotions.
Okay.
About this whole thing.
Yes, sir. All right. Now these, excuse me, the river boats, were they American boats or South Vietnamese boats?
They were American when I got there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And then we'll jump ahead, and we turned them over halfway through my tour.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Once you went out there, was it still based out of Da Nang or somewhere else?
No, we were based, they were based on the Cua Dai River, which is now the Hoi An River. They renamed it, I've noticed.
Okay.
My main place was Hoi An, which is about 25, 30 kilometers south of Da Nang.
Okay.
And what we had was an array along the river there, Jason. I had two swift boats.
Okay.
The swift, you know, you're familiar with swift boats?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Okay. The swift boats were used predominantly for the offshore patrols.
Right.
But two of the boats would come into the river, and they would rotate in pairs.
Okay.
Right at the mouth of the river, there was a coastal group, which was the old junk base.
All right.
It was Vietnamese junk base with American advisors there. And so the swift boats would tie up there.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first came down to the river, I stayed at the coastal group for several days.
Okay.
Till I moved on down to Hoi An. Then further on down, past Hoi An City, there was the patrol PBRs, Patrol Boat River. There were 10 of those down there, squadron based, and they were based out of a Marine camp.
Okay.
Let's see, they would, everybody, when they had any problems with the boats or whatever, they if they couldn't fix them, they would have to go back to Da Nang to the shipyard.
Okay. All right. And at this point, what was your specific assignment?
I was in charge of the operation.
Okay.
It was Operation Sea Tiger.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right.
So what I did, there was a lieutenant that was in charge of the PBRs. He was the commanding officer of that group. And the two swift boat officers that were in charge of their individual boats would come in. Usually it would be the ensign or a JG that was in charge of those boats.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I ran the operation from a MACV headquarters, the Army Advisor headquarters in Hoi An.
Okay.
And we had a TOC there where we operated out of. I had, in addition to two swift boats, the PBRs, and when I came in there, I had two Navy snipers.
Okay.
Had a what they called a duffel bag team, which were sensor planters.
All right.
And these guys did double duties as radio operators in the TOC. And then on call, I had a UDT team that was based out of Da Nang.
Okay. All right. I guess could you talk a little bit about Operation Sea Tiger itself and the purpose of the operation? Was this part of the larger interdiction thing or what?
Yeah, their basic mission was to prevent the interdiction of supplies and weapons and people going basically north to Da Nang.
Okay.
They would funnel down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and then come east, cross the plain, and then try to cross rivers and that sort of thing and infiltrate up toward Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
Our job was as much as we could to prevent that infiltration.
Okay.
And, of course, most of that work went on at night. And so our mode of operation was that we would set night ambushes.
Okay.
That's where we had most of our contacts. And the way that worked is the boats would usually go out. We'd have to clear an area for free fire.
Mm-hmm.
And the boats, whether PBRs or swift boats, they operated in their pairs. And they would go out so that they could set into the riverbank just about twilight, just
okay.
where there's just enough light so that they could set in. And then you would the boats would moor into the side of the riverbank, tie up usually on a tree or something,
mm-hmm.
and put one guy on the bank to with a safety rope, of course, to prevent us being ambushed, and then use our night observation devices to scan the river and the riverbank on the bank on the other side for
mm-hmm.
movement.
Yes, sir.
When I had the two snipers, and they had night observation devices, so you could put those guys on the boat too. To give you, if you just had a one single target, they could. You had a better chance with those guys.
Mm-hmm. All right. All right. And being the commander, did you generally go out with them at night?
I went with them quite a while.
Okay.
You know, I didn't go every night.
Right.
But I. It's hard to say how many times I went out. Actually,
sure.
But
yes, sir.
I went out enough to know that. That it got rather tight
mm-hmm.
sitting there. We would sit there, let's say we sat in at 7 o'clock.
Okay.
And we'd stay till 11 or so. We found out that if there's going to be movement by the bad guys, it was going to be pretty much about 8 or 9 o'clock.
Okay.
When it got dark and they could get out and do stuff. But when it got later in the morning, there just wasn't anything going on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Right. Was there was there a curfew for the Vietnamese? Were they not supposed to be out on the river at night?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they had to be in their villages.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there happened to be another friendly unit operating, then we had to clear the area before we could use it every night. So you had to put in a request to make sure that there was no friendlies out there.
Right.
I don't really remember ever getting turned down.
Okay. All right. Well, since the only, I guess, Vietnamese traffic on the river would be, at that time, would probably be the enemy because of the curfew, what would be, I guess if you could talk a little bit about what would be the sequence of events if you, say you guys saw movement on the river, what would take place at that point?
Well, what you would do basically is, like I say, you operated in two pairs, two PBRs would be together, two swift boats, but they wouldn't be in the same area.
Okay.
Because the PBRs could, they only drew a couple inches. So they could go into water that the swift boats could never get into.
Okay.
So one operated on one end of the river and one on the other.
Mm-hmm.
But basically what you would do is if you saw a single guy, then you would wait till the right opportunity, the closest, and take him under fire.
Okay.
If it was a lot of soldiers in a line, you'd wait till they got just about across from you, and then you'd open up on them.
All right.
Now, that, in that particular scenario, you would get the hell out of there.
Okay.
Fighting from the water with a fiberglass boat, you know, you're not going to kill them all.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're making it, they've got a big target to shoot at. So our element was the element of surprise.
Okay.
That was always a trick, and we got surprised a couple times ourselves.
Mm.
But we did more surprising than they did.
Okay. Sir. All right. Well, speaking of the swift boats and the PBRs, could you talk, I guess, a little bit about how many crew members, how the boats would be armed, that type of thing?
Sure. The swift boats were a 50-foot aluminum hull that were originally designed for working the oil rigs in the down in the Gulf. But as I recall, there was a 50 caliber machine gun right over the top of the cab.
Okay.
And then a 50 and a 60 millimeter mortar over and under on the stern. And I can't remember. I think there was another 50 caliber forward. I just don't remember.
Okay.
And it had, the crew was permanently on board. They had bunks and eating facilities and everything. So they were a self-contained unit.
Okay.
An ensign or a JG would be in charge. And as I recall, there was about five enlisted that were on there.
Okay.
The boats. A lot of them, at that time, they were starting to try to integrate the Vietnamese into taking over the boats.
Mm-hmm.
So they would deploy out of Da Nang, and they would usually have one, maybe two of the crew would be Vietnamese.
Okay.
And sometimes you had there'd be two officers on board, one U.S. and one Vietnamese.
Okay. Yes, sir.
The PBRs were a 35-foot fiberglass that had a water ejection engine, whereas the Swifts only had twin screws. And so the PBRs could get up on step. They could, when they got on step, they drew like an inch or something like that. So they could go in a lot of different places that the Swift boats couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
The obvious problem with the only obvious problem with the PBRs was it was a fiberglass hull. So if they got shot at, it's pretty much going to go right through the hull.
Mm-hmm.
There was a steel plate on both sides where the captain of the boat was, and that was, they did not stay out at night. I mean, they didn't live on the boats.
Okay.
There was seemed to me like there was four four crew members, and it would be a senior enlisted in charge. And God, they had a, seemed like a 50 caliber on the front, but I know they had, one of them had a Honeywell grenade launcher.
Okay.
And they had a 30 caliber on the sides. I can't remember what they had on the fantail. I think it may be another 30 caliber machine gun. It was a pretty heavily armored boat for its size.
Yes, sir.
And when they would go out, they'd go out in pairs, and there would be a junior officer normally in charge of the patrol.
Okay.
So you had a senior enlisted that was in charge of the boat, but then you had like an ensign JG or something like that that would be in charge of the two-boat patrol.
Okay.
And then, you know, occasionally I'd ride one of them, and or the commanding officer of the group would ride them.
All right.
And they patrolled during the day, too. It wasn't just a night thing. But the chances of finding anything in the day were pretty remote. My understanding of the history of this area was that when they first tried to come into this, to the river, about 2 years before, they had actually been thrown out. I mean, they'd been shot out of it.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many bad guys along the riverbanks.
Mm. Yes, sir.
And in the interim, they finally... it got pacified to an extent they could get the boats in there.
Right. Yes, sir.
But we were the only riverine operation, Jason, that was north of the Delta.
Mm, okay.
See, everything else was down in south. And so we were, sometimes we almost felt like stepchildren.
Right.
You know, because everything you read or heard about was down in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
In the Mekong Delta, and like I say, we were the northernmost entity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Well, along those lines, because the focus was in the Delta, was there, you know, you say you almost felt like being stepchildren, but was there any problems, did any problems arise because of that, say for supplies and things like that?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right.
We got everything we needed.
Okay. All right. Well, these night ambushes, how from your perspective, how successful were they? Did they work as far as stopping the enemy's plans?
Oh, yeah, they definitely worked. I became a big advocate, if you're going to fight a war, a clandestine war like it had developed, the only thing you could do is go out at night and play their game with them.
Okay.
That's when they were making their attack. So you had to put this fear into them that they never knew where we were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And if you sat back and went into your compound at night, they knew exactly where you were.
Right.
So all they got to do is set up some mortars and lob them in there.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're carrying those mortar tubes down the riverbank and all of a sudden they get shot up, they're going to have second thoughts about doing it the next time.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, I know it's impossible to know exactly, but could you give me an estimate about how often you guys would actually find something in the river at night, would make contact?
I've never really thought that question out.
Okay.
You know, and this is a wild guess, but I would say maybe ever fifth or sixth patrol.
Mm, okay.
Yeah, you know, most of the time you come back empty.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about that.
Right. Yes, sir.
But you never knew, and you never knew when they were going to see you.
Mm-hmm.
That was the because if you made a big silhouette and they were walking and they saw you. I remember the first night I went on an ambush with a swift boat. And we were set in, and we'd been there a couple hours, and all of a sudden, whoosh, right over the top of the cab was a RPG.
Mm. Oh.
And said, well, we better get out of here because they got us boresighted.
Right. Yes, sir. That was your, was that your first encounter with the enemy then?
No, my first encounter was the next day, I think, or the day after that, I got in the Coastal Group 14, and I was living it there with the advisors down there. There were two officers and two enlisted.
Okay.
And their comment to me was, you know, you might as well get your combat action ribbon and get it out of the way. So we boarded a Boston Whaler, a 14-foot with a machine gun on the bow. And you could go down this one branch of the river headed toward the province that was just south of us. And there was a village down there that was 100% D.C. And, of course, in a Boston Whaler, you don't have a whole lot of protection.
Right.
And so we got down there. Sure enough, you know, we got about, I don't know, 100 meters, maybe not that close to them. And boy, it opened up on us. So these guys did some racetrack patterns with the Whaler back and forth, and we were firing at them. And, you know, that was my first encounter with the VC. And we went on back to the Coastal Group, and they said, well, that's taken care of now. You know?
Right. Yes, sir.
But it was a funny thing, you know, that village stayed there, and it was set. Everybody knew that village was VC.
Mm-hmm.
And never anything happened to it. It's set on the other, across the province line. We were in Quang Nam province.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the restrictions that was the war that was almost unreal, that you couldn't chase the bad guys across the province line without prior approval from both province headquarters. So if you were in hot contact with somebody, it would be like, well, we're here in Missouri and Arkansas, just south of us.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be like fighting a war here, and you couldn't chase the bad guys into Arkansas.
Right.
But you knew Arkansas theoretically was a friendly province.
Mm-hmm.
They're all part of the South.
Right.
Yes. And that really bound our hands in some of those cases.
Mm-hmm. Being relatively new to Vietnam at that point, did that cause any impact on you? Did it make you question what, you know, the wisdom in it and what was going on with that?
Oh, sure, yeah, mm-hmm. And it just got more so as I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you just could not cross that line.
Right.
If they got across that border, then they were safe, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And it was a whole nother... So that went out of our area of operation, too. So
okay.
It fell into somebody else's. I think the AmeriCal division had that.
Okay.
You remember the infamous Mr. Cali?
Right,
and
yes,
that
sir.
Thing. Well, they were just south of it. In fact, one of the first things... I hadn't been in the river probably... got two weeks, then we got a visit from a reporter and a Navy captain, as I remember, and they wanted to ride out into that area, and they didn't see anything. They just rode the river. We took them down there toward the south, because we didn't want to take them down there where they're going to get shot. That's number one. But
right.
They wanted to see what that area looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess where that village was not too far south of where I was operating out of.
Mm, okay. Yes, sir.
But I never saw it, obviously.
All right. Would this have been in Quang Nam province?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, one question I meant to ask you a little bit earlier. Given the fact that it was fairly late in the war, how was morale among the Americans at that point?
The guys I had, I thought that they were, they had good morale.
Okay.
You know, I never had any problem with anybody. The only time I ever had any problems with anybody is after we turned the boats over.
Okay.
And of course, the Vietnamese took the Swift boats over entirely. I don't think there was ever any advisors. And the PBR's guys rotated out, but there were still some that were there, particularly some, a couple senior guys. And they did not want to ride the boats with the Vietnamese.
Okay.
And so I didn't press the issue. I stayed on as a senior advisor.
Okay.
And I rode the boats, and in fact, many times I was still running the operation.
Okay.
But there, I don't remember anybody else offhand riding the boats after the turnover. There may have been one or two Swift boat guys, but the PBR guys refused to do it, and I wasn't going to push them. They'd been through enough, and they had just a month or so to go till they rotated home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it really wasn't worth it to anybody's time to do it.
Right. Yes, sir. Well, that brings up another question I wanted to ask you, which was about the South Vietnamese Navy sailors and your impressions of them.
Boy, you can run the gauntlet on that one.
Okay.
There were, and I think, you know, it probably is a reflection of any military organization, but the guys that were the toughest, the guys that really wanted to get to combat, were the ones that had come down from the north you know, when they divided the country and the people had a chance to go south. These guys were really fierce warriors, and they wanted to kill the VC and NVA. There were some that were from the city that got drafted in some fashion.
Okay.
And they weren't always the most energetic that were working. And so, you know, you never really knew what, you know, a boat would go down, and you never knew whether it was really somebody doing some mischief to it or whether they really had problems. And but that was their issue. Of course, they've been fighting the war for years. So in some respects, you had to weigh that, you know, I'm going home in a few months, and they're still going to be here fighting.
Right.
And so, you know, my enthusiasm level may have been at, you know, 99%, but theirs might have been at 40.
Okay.
They knew that there's no end to this thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have to keep fighting forever, maybe.
Right.
So I tempered my evaluations of what they were doing and went along kind of with what they had in mind, you know. And they would run hot and cold. They had some great officers. I just, some of them I would go any place with. And some of them were lukewarm, but I really think that's a reflection of any place you go.
Right. Yes, sir. All right.
But I remember the guys from the north, Jason, that they were the ones that really wanted to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And the coastal group guys, the junk sailors,
okay,
they were another hardcore group. Now, I wasn't an advisor to them. They didn't really come under my jurisdiction, but I spent a lot of time with them and rode junks.
Okay.
And spent a lot of nights in the coastal group. And they were tough guys, and you could tell the old ones had tattooed across their chest "SATCOM," which means kill communists.
Right, yes, sir.
And I was told that if they were ever captured, that they would, that part of their body would be skinned off alive.
Right, yes, sir. All right. Would you guys ever coordinate operations with them?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we ran a lot of coordinated operations. The area of operation I was in was run by the Korean Marine Corps.
Okay.
Had a huge Korean base down there. And I ran operations with the Korean Marines, the South Vietnamese Army, the RFs and PFs, which are their militia, National
right.
Guard kind of guys. And also occasionally with the Marine Corps once or twice, because they had a group down there, plus they had a cap. Where the PBRs were was actually a cap base.
Okay.
And so we worked with them a bit.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times we would be at the blocking force. We'd insert and then try to block the escape of the bad guys.
Okay.
Depends on who you worked with. You know, the RFs and PFs were marginal.
Mm-hmm.
And the Koreans, Koreans were good when you could get them.
Okay.
I was convinced later that the Koreans had a quota of how many they could lose themselves,
mm-hmm.
how many friendly casualties they could take.
Right.
Because at the first of a quarter, you'd see their operation tempo pick up.
Okay.
And then as some of them got killed, toward the end of the quarter, you'd almost not see them out at all.
Right. Yes, sir.
But the Vietnamese were scared of the Koreans, I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
They put the fear of God into them.
Right.
Because I'd driven by the compound and see guys hung out there.
Mm. Right.
The VC they'd caught, and they just hung them up and left them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, right. Was there any difference in the way they operated as well, or was it just things like that, fear tactics is displaying the enemy that they had killed?
Yeah, I think, you know, they were just, Americans are sensitive to a certain extent, you know. They, how am I going to describe this? They were, they have more feelings, and you get the Koreans, and you think, they don't really care, you know. And I think that terrified the Vietnamese.
Okay.
That, perhaps it's Oriental mindset. I don't know, but I do know that they did get that they put the fear of God into the South Koreans.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, you mentioned a moment ago the advisory role. Was that something you had all along from the point that you took over Sea Tiger, or was that something that came a little later?
Well, I think it came a little later. We didn't have any definitive plans, as I remember.
Okay.
And then, of course, President Nixon was in office, and they decided at the high level to get us out of Vietnam, and mm-hmm. the way was to turn over the operation of the various units. So once I got there, they started drawing down
mm-hmm.
A lot of the manpower all across the board. You know, Army, Marines, a whole bit. And somewhere, I think, early, some planner probably had it all mapped out.
Okay.
But it was, I'm going to guess, about March, February or March, when I found out that the boats were going to be turned over. We knew they were going to be turned over eventually.
Mm-hmm.
It was just when.
Right. Yes, sir.
And as I recall, it was like May of 70 that we turned the boats over to them.
Okay. All right. And did that change your role very much? Did that have much of an impact on your role?
Yeah, sure it did, because, you know, now all of a sudden, instead of calling the shots,
mm-hmm.
now it's advising the shots.
Okay.
And I was working, I had a counterpart that was a lieutenant commander.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and he was a great guy. I couldn't have wanted a better counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
And so we worked together on it. We'd go out in operations and that sort of stuff. And as we got further into it, there would be times when I would be back to my old role of running it.
Mm-hmm.
Here again, you know, he'd been fighting this war for, I don't know, 20 years.
Right.
And, you know, I was there for a year. And he had a family in Da Nang. And so he'd want to go up there and see them.
Mm-hmm.
And when he'd go up there to see them, I wound up calling the shots again.
Mm-hmm.
So I was essentially running it, the operation.
Right. Yes, sir.
As an advisor.
All
but
right.
I could, the thing about it, though, you know, I could get air power, you know, if we need the gunships or something like that.
Right.
Where they might have a tough time getting it.
Okay. All right. So that was then that was one of your roles as advisor to be a connection to the American firepower?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, not to get too far ahead with everything, but do you know what happened to your counterpart?
No.
Okay.
I have no idea. I do belong to the counterpart organization,
mm-hmm.
and no, unfortunately, I have no idea what happened to any of the guys that I knew over there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Fearful that they probably all perished.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Or wound up in one of those re-education camps.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. I guess if we could switch gears for a moment, talk a little bit about the enemy, your impressions of them, and how they operated.
Well, of course, your VC, which was your local guys that worked during the day and became VC at night, they were. It's a mixed bag, you know. Some of them are probably really good. I never knew any of them personally that I'm aware of.
Sure.
You know, their tactics were pretty much hit and run. The NVA, I only had really one encounter, personal encounter with the NVA, and we caught them in an ambush.
Okay.
Probably about 30 of them. And going north to Da Nang one night.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, from everything I've read and seen since then, they were all good soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
I never had any naval encounters with any of them.
Yes, sir. All right. did the enemy? I know you guys would have contact with them on the river,
mm-hmm.
but did they ever mortar or rocket the base camp there as well? Did that ever happen?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. they would periodically mortar the compound there in Hoi An,
okay.
where we were living.
Mm-hmm.
It usually wasn't a 3 or 4 rounds is about all, enough to get everybody awake and heading for the bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
The compound actually set pretty much in the city itself.
Okay.
And so you could hear the shrapnel raining down on the rooftops.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't happen all that frequently. I kept my room in Da Nang, and that would be my R&R site.
Okay.
In country.
Right. Yes,
and I remember going up there, and they seemed like they had that siren going every night.
Mm.
With a mortar attack someplace.
Right.
But, like I told you previously, that was such a huge city and so much military installations that it was hard to say where in the world they were mortaring.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember any direct mortaring in Da Nang.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But, yeah, they did it a few times in Hoi An.
Right. Yes, sir. Well, since you mentioned that, could you talk a little bit about Hoi An itself and your quarters there?
Oh, it was an Army advisor compound,
okay.
MACV, and it was actually kind of interesting because we had the Navy, a small Navy detachment there from the duffel bag team, the sensor team,
mm-hmm.
and so there was myself and a Navy lieutenant, I think it was Lieutenant or JG, who ran the team. But most of the people in there were Army, and there was one Marine. And when I got there, of course, the commanding officer had his own quarters, and I slept in a bunk room with three other guys, and I think they were all Army captains.
Okay.
And you know, it was just a open air not an open air, but there's screens and mosquito netting and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember cases, somebody, one of the officers left, got transferred. But outside the commanding officer, I was like the fourth senior guy.
Okay.
And so one guy got transferred. Well, there's one bunk room that had air conditioning, and it was for three people, three senior people below the commanding officer.
Okay.
And I squeezed into that third slot somewhere about 3 months into my tour there.
Mm-hmm.
So I had rather nice quarters. It's a small compound. Wasn't anything sprawling. It was like an inner city compound, if you can envision this thing.
Okay.
I remember about three blocks from the waterfront. So it wasn't a big walk to catch when I'd want to ride on the river, I'd just get hold of one of the boats and they'd come down and pick me up off the pier.
Mm-hmm.
And away we'd go. And then when it was over, they'd drop me back there.
Yes, sir.
If it was a night op and I was on a swift boat, I'd go back to the coastal group and bunk there.
Okay.
But they had it wasn't a lot of people there. There was a galley, and they had decent food, and they had little clubs, two clubs,
mm-hmm.
and had a little outdoor area where they showed the movie at night. But like I say, it's in the middle of the city.
Okay.
Now, I got the impression Hoi An has changed 180 since I left, because now if you read any tour group itinerary that goes to Vietnam, they always stop at Hoi An.
Right.
It's become a major shopping, and they talk about these huge hotels.
Right.
And, you know, I have trouble envisioning what all that took place, but apparently the whole thing changed. I used to get some exercise. I would I'd actually run outside the compound, and they had an old soccer stadium there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd get on to the soccer stadium and run around the track.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing was really beat up, and a lot of potholes and things like that. And I guess they've cleaned all that up and made it a real tourist area.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bridge that was well known there, a famous one, and I can't remember, but I remember going down there with one of the Army captains said, you need to come see this one day, and I think that's one of the main sites now on civilian tours.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Is it the Japanese-built bridge?
I think it is, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, sir, okay.
Yep.
All right. All right. Well, being based there inside the city of Hoi An, do you have much contact with the local civilian population?
Only the ones that work there.
Okay.
Inside the compound, you know, like that would maybe work in the galley kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
There was a woman that did the wash, and she'd take your uniform down there to the river and beat it on a rock. And there was a little PX there. There's another woman that worked there.
Mm-hmm.
But that was pretty much it. No, we didn't go out at night and go to any, well, I don't even know if they had any clubs or anything there.
Right.
But no, I didn't. I had very little contact with the civilian population.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, what little contact you did have with them, what was your impression of just your Vietnamese civilians?
Well, I thought they were very nice people. You know, they were polite. There was, how am I going to say it? The dress was, I always liked the dresses that the young ladies wore. Those, I can't remember what the name of them was.
The Al Dyes?
Yeah.
Yes,
the Al Dyes,
okay.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had absolutely no problem with the Vietnamese. The fact is, I enjoyed my job, and I liked the role of advisor.
Mm-hmm.
If I hadn't had a family, if I'd have been a bachelor, I would have extended.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I felt that strong about what we were doing and how we were doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have probably faced a divorce if I had extended. So.
Right.
But,
Yes, sir. All right. Well, I guess getting back to the operations themselves and Operation Sea Tiger, we've talked about, I guess, about how things worked, but are there any memorable moments, any memorable firefights, anything like that, that stick out in your mind that you could possibly mention?
Yeah, there's a couple. Of course, I will say that I lost the duffel bag team before the turnover. They
okay.
Their mode of operation, I'll talk about that for just a minute.
Sure, go ahead.
McNamara came up with a concept of planting electronic devices, sensing devices across the DMZ to cut down the infiltration. I don't know how that ever materialized, but what I had was the sensor team that did that on a local level. And
okay.
What we would do is go out and have a trail, find a trail on the riverbank and get it cleared. And they planted these sensors. They dug holes and planted them. And they had a little antenna sticking up. And some of them would pick up acoustics, some metal. There was about three or four different kinds.
Okay.
And you'd plant them, I'm going to say about 20 yards apart, in a series of normally four, as I recall. And they would plot the coordinates of where that trail was.
Okay.
We would then go back, and usually we had about three or four trails that were active. God, my own dog just we had two batteries. Artillery batteries. One was a 105 Arvin battery that was right outside our compound.
Okay.
And then there was a 155 battery that the Korean Marines had.
Mm-hmm.
And we cleared those. We'd clear those coordinates every night. And then they would sit in the TOC and monitor the coordinates.
Okay.
And if they had any activity, somebody walking down the trail,
right,
then they would call in a fire mission.
Hmm. Okay.
And you never knew how successful it was, because first of all, if you ever had a successful one, somebody would come and pull the body away anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it certainly would cut down traffic.
Yes, sir.
On the trail. And they had one other interesting. They did it one time, and I thought it was a terrific operation. We had one island that was in the middle of the river that was nothing but trouble, bad
okay.
guys and booby traps and everything else every time you went into the place. And the lieutenant that was in charge of it came up with the concept, and they planted claymores, one at each end of this trail, probably about 300 yards apart.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not that far. Maybe it was a couple hundred yards.
Okay.
And they set. They actually set in a in one of the swift boats off the river, and the guy in the TOC monitored the traffic on the trail. And they got movement on this trail, and they could tell which end it was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And when they got a certain point, they set off the first claymore.
Okay.
And the reaction from the people that were getting the claymore
right.
was to turn and run the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
So they counted down about 20 seconds and set off the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And they killed, I think, about four or five guys.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And got some weapons. We only did it one time.
Right.
And then just before we turned over the boats, these guys were out operating in the same island, and one of the guys hit a booby trap, and it blew his leg off. And we started to I went with them a lot of times, but I wasn't with them that day.
Okay.
And it blew his leg off, and we got a medevac chopper to come in, and two or three of them were wounded, and they took small arms fire, and the chopper couldn't get in, and then they had to scramble some gunships, and when they finally got him in and medevaced him out, he was dead. And the lieutenant was banged up. He had a lot of wounds, and there was one or other one that was hurt. So the team dissolved.
Okay.
And that was just before the turnover.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Then I had another interesting experience with the SEALs.
Okay.
I have all the greatest respect for SEALs, okay?
Yes, sir.
They're truly the epitome of the warrior, but I had one experience, and they sent a team of SEALs up to try to extract some of the body snatch like they were doing in the Delta.
Right.
And SEALs, you can't, my limited experience with it, you really can't talk to them very much because they know everything. And so they had to go down the river to this, it was the same island, same little place that I've just described in the last two incidents.
Yes, sir.
And so they were going to set in, you know, like we normally do at ambush, they were going to set in the evening, and they were going to, they had these rafts, rubber rafts. And I said, now, the best thing to do, I said, is just hook on to the side of a swift boat and just let it take you down the river. And then when you get close, you can cut loose and drift in. I said, no problem. I said, we don't need that swift boat. I said, we're just going to go down the river.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was, that particular evening, I was out watching the movie, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, it was still light. And the river I just heard all this machine gun fire.
Oh, wow. Right.
And you probably guessed it. The friendlies, Vietnamese on the bank saw these two rubber rafts going down there, or one. I think it was two.
Right.
And took them under fire. Thought they were VC.
Oh, no. Right.
Well, the only thing, I guess poor shooting was the only thing that saved them.
Right.
And they got onto another little island, and I finally got the firing stopped, told them they were friendly. And so by that time, of course, the word was out that they were out there going down the river.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked our intelligence officer about it later, and he said, as far as he knows, they didn't get anything.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right. Sir.
Well. And then I was on one interesting thing, too, later on, was a prisoner release.
Okay.
It was sometime in the summer, as I recall, of 70, and the South Vietnamese decided that they would try to initiate a prisoner release exchange.
Okay.
And they needed a lieutenant commander from my corps to be the liaison officer. And I was the only lieutenant commander in I Corps, apparently, because they called me out of the river and said, you're going to have to go to Saigon to meet with these people.
Mm-hmm.
So I flew down to Saigon and met. There was the planners there in the naval headquarters, and the Vietnamese, and I think it was the Des Moines. It was a heavy cruiser, 8-inch guns.
Okay.
And I think it was the XO that was there. And what the plan was is to put, they had about 70, maybe 80 prisoners. And most of them, or some of them, were fishermen from the north that had strayed across. Others were true prisoners. But most of them, I think the real soldiers, were missing limbs, i.e. legs mm-hmm. and things like that. And so they put them on the Vung Tau, which was a old U.S. Navy LST.
Okay.
And the Vung Tau was the flagship of the Vietnamese Navy.
Okay.
And they loaded them in the south someplace down there,
mm-hmm.
Maybe off that prison down there, they had island, and brought them north, and they pulled into Da Nang Harbor, and that's where I boarded it. They must have been as many news media on there is they had prisoners.
Mm. Wow.
I mean, there was news people from every country you can imagine.
Huh, right.
And I was going to get a berth someplace, and I went out, there were no bunks available. I remember I had a small detachment of communication guys.
Okay.
And my job was to be a liaison with the Navy ships, the ship that was the Des Moines, and the FAC, the forward air controller,
mm-hmm.
and anybody else that had anything to do with the Navy,
okay.
or U.S. forces, I should say.
Yes, sir.
So the plan was they had three Yabuda junks, and we went north off the DMZ, and an International Red Cross was on board.
Okay.
And so the next morning, I went up to the bridge and stand there behind the captain, and the seas were pretty rough. And the guy from the International Red Cross was there, and he said, "Captain, I think it's too rough to land to set these people off." And I never will forget this, Jason. He says, "We're going to put them off of here." And he turned to me and he says, "Sometimes you just got to make a decision." And I don't know what it was, but that thing has hung with me for 40 years or whatever it's been. But
right.
And so the Red Cross guy just kind of walked off in frustration, I think. And
right.
And they brought it, like an LST, so you drop the bow
uh-huh.
and bring the junk in. And we had three, but they only needed two. Actually, to put the prisoners in there, so they loaded one, and it went out of the bow, and they brought the second one in. They gave each one of them a little bag, like
okay.
you get used to get in airlines. You know, it had some toiletry stuff in them.
Okay.
And somewhere I have some pictures of all this stuff, and the second one got clear.
Okay.
And you could see the north, the DMZ area.
Yes, sir.
And as soon as the second boat got clear of the side, every one of them tossed the bag over the side of the junk.
Mm-hmm.
And then they headed north, and I was talking to the observation aircraft, and he said he saw two North Vietnamese patrol boats come out to meet them.
Mm-hmm.
And escort them back.
Okay.
And that's the last I ever heard. We turned around and went back to Da Nang, and they let me off at Da Nang, and anybody, probably all the news people got off at Da Nang too.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was an interesting few days.
Oh, sure. Yes, sir. Right. All right. Were there, was this in exchange for some South Vietnamese as well? Did that
No, I think that the intent was to try to get something started.
Okay. Okay.
You know, they were just doing this as a goodwill gesture
mm-hmm.
to try to get something started, but to the best of my knowledge, nothing ever materialized mm-hmm. out of it.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, let's see. I was looking at your questionnaire here that you filled out.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, I know you mentioned Operation Sea Tiger, but you also mentioned about Operation Chi Lang.
That was the Vietnamese. Once they took over the boat,
okay.
It became Chi Lang 1.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I guess we could talk a little bit more about that Vietnamization program and handing, turning the boats over to the Vietnamese. How did you feel about that how did you feel about the program of Vietnamization in general?
Well, I'm not sure I even had a feeling. You know,
okay.
It's something that's, when you get in the military, you know, you're told to do something. I guess I was probably apprehensive whether the Vietnamese could do it.
Okay.
At the time. But it's one of those things that, you know, it's going to happen, so you make the best of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that they had some really good sailors, Mm-hmm. But I didn't know about the vast majority of them because
right.
I hadn't worked with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just worked with a handful of them. So it's one of those things that you're apprehensive, but it's going to happen, so you might as well just make the best of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, and again, you know, in retrospect, it was the only way for us to exit the country.
Yes, sir.
If we had not done that, then no telling how many years, if we kept fighting the war like we were.
Mm-hmm.
And the war was fought entirely wrong, but from a military standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
I've equated it to trying to win a football game and not being able to cross the 50-yard line.
Mm, right.
You
know, yes,
you couldn't go north of the DMZ.
Right. Yes, sir. That's an interesting comparison, man. Like,
mm-hmm.
Pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Like. Yes, sir.
There was no way. I did have a couple other between the time we turned the boat over until I became advisor, there was a lapse time of about 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay.
And I really wasn't, as I recall, they really weren't sure whether I was going to be the senior advisor or whether they were really going to have an advisor. And then they elected, and so they thought that I might wind up going back to that Coastal Surveillance Center.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took a driving tour north. Took the Jeep. I had a Jeep and drove up Highway 1 to the DMZ.
Okay.
And I stopped at each of the coastal. I think there were three coastal groups north of Da Nang.
Yes, sir.
And so I wound up going through Wei and on up into that area. And I did get to see from Coastal Group 11, which was just south of the DMZ, I got to see a B-52 strike going in.
Mm, okay.
You just see it way off, and it was, I guess it was in layoffs along the Ho Chi Minh Trail that they were doing it. And the guy who was at senior advisor at Coastal Group 11 had actually gone through the counterinsurgency training with me.
Okay.
So we were friends, and we got mortared that one night I was there. I think I spent two nights with him. We got mortared one night, and then I saw the strike going in. So both of those were interesting little events.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right.
And there was one other one that was before, back hopping back a bit, Jason, was in before I went into the river. It was not long after I checked into the Da Nang when I first got there, and they wanted to give me an orientation trip into what the coastal surveillance ships were doing. So I rode a 82-foot Coast Guard ship out of Da Nang in December.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, I have a lot of admiration for those guys, because we hit the South China Sea and went every way but forward.
Yes, sir.
And this was I told you about getting seasick out of Newport. Well, this was the other time.
Okay. Yes, sir.
And I swear to God, I thought I was going to die that first night.
Mm.
But they would check in. They went to one of the coastal groups south of Da Nang and visited radar stations that were on islands out there in the South China Sea, and inspected sandpans and did some night firing missions.
Mm-hmm.
And we were out 5 days. It came back, and they were going to be in for, I think it was a day and a half, and then going back out for 5 days.
Mm, okay.
That was their rotation.
Right.
So I had a lot of admiration for those guys.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. When you weren't, if you did have any free time at all, how would you spend it?
You mean in Hoi An?
Yes, sir.
Oh, reading mostly.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You know, and they had movies. It's, you know, there was a lot of boring times.
Mm-hmm.
You can only do so much of this stuff, but somebody said, you know, war is 99% boring and 1% sheer terror.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty close to it.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. How about R&R? Did you get a chance to go on R&R?
Went to Hawaii.
Okay.
For 5 nights.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yes,
met
sir.
The wife there.
All right. one other question about the about your counterpart. How were you able to communicate with him and the other Vietnamese? Could you speak enough Vietnamese, or could they speak enough English?
They spoke perfect English.
Okay.
they'd worked with so many counterparts and people over the years.
Uh-huh. Right.
That they spoke great English. Now my Vietnamese by that time was pretty much down to 2, 3, or 4 words.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yes, sir.
I had no trouble communicating with them.
Okay.
The interesting thing, I told you that my best friend was killed over there.
Yes, sir.
And this guy had worked with him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He had, I'm not sure if he was his counterpart, but they had worked together in this RAG group.
Hmm.
In fact, a couple of the officers that were in this that I was working with had known my friend.
Hmm. How did you discover that?
I don't know. We just got to talking one day
about
it, and I said, you know, that Dale Meyercord was a good friend of mine. He'd been killed over there, and I said, geez, they, you know, we worked with him in the RAG group.
Yes, sir.
And I thought at the time, it's kind of saying, whoa, they worked with him, and he got killed. Is this going to be a, something that's in my future here in a short order?
Right.
So it did give me, you know, some thoughts of what might lead to, but
yes, sir.
Nothing obviously happened.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, is there anything else we should cover before talk about the end of your tour?
I don't guess so. I didn't do anything with tell you about the UDT guys.
Okay. Yes, sir.
But what I predominantly used them for was to blow bunkers along the riverbanks.
Okay.
And there were numerous bunkers, and I guess that's where the fighting was the fiercest when they tried to cut when it came in the first time. But we'd go on ground sweeps along the river and slightly inland, and they used C4. And would just plant it and break the back of the bunkers.
Okay.
Collapse them in.
Right.
But that was pretty much, there was an old bridge I remember they were trying to get out of the water, and it had been blown up and was preventing us from going any further to the west, and they dove down on it and put some C4 and did some damage, but one of the guys got really badly cut on the iron, and I think that was I can't even remember if we got the whole bridge dropped or not, but I know he was a Vietnamese frog man, and we got him out of there, and I don't remember if we ever got back to that area or not.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, you mentioned the enemy, the bunkers there on the river.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit more about how the enemy would try to use the environment like that to his advantage?
Yeah, well, the bunkers would have been along the riverbank. The bunkers were so thick, the walls were so thick, that unless you had a direct hit on one of them through the mouth, they're almost impregnable.
Okay.
Fortunately, by the time I got there, most of the bunkers were abandoned or not used. I don't ever recall getting shot at from a bunker, but we'd still destroy them just to prevent their use.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, they would conceal themselves, and that the island I was telling you about, they had that thing heavily booby-trapped. So you'd go in there and try to to weed them out, and you never knew when you're going to turn the corner and find the booby traps were the biggest nightmare in there.
Okay.
They just you had. I stepped over one day.
Oh wow.
And and that was another thing that the UDT guys were doing, because when we'd go in and we'd find booby traps, they would explode them.
Okay.
And he said, you know, you just stepped over a booby trap. And I said that ground looked like it had been turned up, and that's why I didn't step on it. It was like I think it was a 105 round. The worst round that I ever heard was a 16-inch round that was booby trap.
Yes, sir.
And you see, you went in this field, and there was one square that was brown. The rest of it was green. So you knew that there was a booby trap under there. And when they cleared away, it was a 16-inch gun, probably from the New Jersey projectile.
Yes, sir.
And so we got behind a little berm there when he exploded. And I never heard so much shrapnel in my life. It was just like the whole air was alive over your head.
Oh,
just
wow.
Whistling.
Right.
I thought, man, if it had been there when that thing went off, there wouldn't be anybody alive around you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Was that primarily the kind of booby traps they used, unexploded ordnance, that, that
yeah.
type of thing? Okay. All right. And you mentioned, of course, getting off of the boat and going onto the island. Was that something you guys did quite a bit of, actually getting off of the boats and onto the, and walking around the land?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we did. Now, the boat crew wouldn't.
Okay.
They didn't go off, but, you know, I went off several times on operations, and I'm not sure I was supposed to, really, but I did.
All right. Well, who would you be working with then if the boat crew itself would not get off of the boats?
You mean on the shore? Usually,
yes, sir.
Well, I'd go with for the bunkers. We had the UDT guys.
Right. Okay.
And then after we turned the boats over, I don't remember having. I think the UDT guys went away too.
Okay.
And what I'd do then is go on ops with the RFs and PFs.
Okay.
A bit, and more or less to make sure they were going to do what they're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I mean, that's not like it happened every day or anything like that. That's a
right. Okay. All right. Yes, sir. Well, any other memorable moments or even funny moments, anything like that sticks out that you could talk about?
The only other thing, I've made some notes here. The only other thing I think I hadn't covered is, and I spent one evening on a tour of a nasty boat.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, the guys, it's a SEALs kind of thing. That the boats are... As I recall, it's like a swift boat that was trimmed down and seemed like it could get about 70 miles an hour out of it, and it was used for insertion.
Okay.
We just went on an offshore patrol off the coast one night.
All right.
And that was interesting just to do it.
Yes, sir.
I'm trying to think of it. It's semi-amusing. Not wasn't then, but I had my Jeep stolen.
Oh, really?
Yeah, about a month before I was leaving country.
Mm-hmm.
They stole it right out of the compound.
Hmm.
And I never did figure out what happened, and I don't guess they ever recovered it.
Oh, wow. Yes, sir.
Somebody got into the MacV compound and stole my Jeep.
Right. All right. Well, anything else then before talking about the end of your tour?
I think not. That's...
Okay. All right. What was the end of your tour like, and was there any sort of out processing?
Yeah. You know, you had to go. I think I went back to Da Nang. You had to turn in your weapons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you had to turn in your boots too.
Okay.
And all your I think I turned in everything, fatigues and everything that they had. Now, in one of the bunker escapades, we'd always send in. We had a UDT guy. He was an E6, and he was sort of our tunnel rat.
Okay.
And I got to be good friends with him, and he went in this one, and he came back out, and he said, "Found a rifle in here. You want it?" I said, "Sure." So it was a Chinese communist SKS.
Okay.
All rusty and what have you, and they took it back to the PBR base and cleaned it up for me.
Mm-hmm.
Put it in their vat of oil, and so anyway, I registered that and brought that back on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine doing that today, huh?
Right.
Yeah, I got this rifle I want to check in.
Yeah, right.
You probably get arrested right there on the scene.
Right, sir.
But yeah, I was walking through the airport carrying this thing in a bag.
Mm-hmm.
But they took everything that was there, and I guess they, you know, they recycle it to the Vietnamese.
Mm, okay. Yes, sir.
And then boarded the aircraft, and everybody gave a big cheer when they took off.
Right.
And flew into L.A., and I didn't, to be honest with you, I never knew what to expect because you heard all the stories about the anti-war protesters.
Right.
At the airports and what have you. I never saw any, fortunately. None of them were there to meet me.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we were all in uniform, and then everybody divided up where they were going. My flight was to Memphis, and the wife and parents met us in Memphis. And never saw any signs of protest. Of course, Memphis is, you're not going to find it, but protest there, I don't think.
Right. Yes, sir.
But that's pretty much the out processing that I recall.
Okay. All right. Well, this may be a silly question, but how did you feel about leaving?
Well, I was glad to leave and come home, but because I had a family.
Yes, sir.
But at the same time, I felt that I would have liked to stayed to continue on doing what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing about it. When you come out of a combat zone, at least for me, you have your mind is totally changed.
Okay.
And mine was focused on killing Vietnamese, North Vietnamese, and VC.
Yes, sir.
And I've had people tell me that talked to me after I came back that they didn't even know me.
Mm. Yes, sir.
That my focus in life was just that, what I just told you. And to adapt to another way of life all of a sudden was a bit taxing. You know, and I found out nobody wanted to talk about the war.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to engage. I was so enthusiastic that I wanted to talk about what was going on over there.
Right.
Nobody wanted to talk to me about it.
Mm. Yes, sir.
I remember going to a party after I came back and friends that I'd been in high school with. And I thought, well, these guys surely will. And, you know, they just kind of nothing.
Mm.
So it's I felt a great deal of frustration, you know, and I did a lot of things, I think, that were that I didn't have to do just because I got so enthusiastic about. You know, I didn't have to get off the boats to go on. Mm-hmm. Nobody expected me to do that.
Yes, sir.
But I was gung-ho, I guess is
right.
The best word to describe it. And I would have probably gone anywhere and done anything at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They said they had an aborted rescue mission trying to in the north.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether you've talked to anybody about that or not, but you know they thought they had this prison camp pinpointed, and they made an insertion by helicopter, two helicopters trying to rescue the prisoners, and it was deserted.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
They got back out, and that was in the news. And I remember telling my dad, I said, I would have really liked to go on something like that. And he said, what? he didn't have, you know, he couldn't envision
uh-huh.
trying to do something like that. But that's just the mindset that changed me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And things that had been important before were no longer important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it's a life and death situation, you just change your whole set of values.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. How long did it take you to adjust to back to life outside of the war zone again?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I can't answer that.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was probably, it's not like you put a timeline on it.
Sure.
It just happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after your, I you know, probably a couple years at least, maybe longer.
Right.
Yes, sometimes I don't think I ever adjusted.
Yes, sir. Were you surprised by the fact that the people in the United States at that point just didn't want to talk about it? And how much had the United States changed from your perspective since you had started your tour?
It hadn't changed.
Okay.
You know, nobody, the war was a long way away. It's probably like what's going on right now in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really realizes what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing's changed, so there's a feeling of frustration that nobody really cares.
Okay. Yes, sir.
And so, you know, they do when it initially starts.
Right.
And then after it goes on for some of its prescribed period, then the mindset just says, oh, well, it's just another day in a combat zone, you know, and it doesn't, it's not impacting me, so I don't care.
Right.
It was a feeling of frustration, but you know, it was kind of interesting because for a year basically, except for R&R, I'd never gone out at night. It was, except for operations.
Right.
And it was always in the compound, and all of a sudden you could drive down to the corner.
Right.
And do this and do that. So that was an amazing just change of an environment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Sir. All right. Well, did you, once you got home, did you follow the developments on TV and through the newspapers?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I stayed very interested in it, and particularly to see if there was anything going on where I had been.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes, sir.
In areas I'd been. And, you know, I still read books and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And can identify with different places and things that take place.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, at the time you left, did you have any idea about the way the war was going to conclude? Did you have any inkling of that?
No.
Okay.
Had none.
All right.
You know, as far as I was concerned, it might go on for another 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, did you remain in the Navy after coming home from Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. No, I had 12 years in, 10 years, I don't know. No, I had another two ships and another two shore assignments.
Okay.
And eventually retired after 21 years.
Okay. Yes, sir. So what year would that have been?
I retired in 81.
In 81, okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Just talking about the war, again, I asked you about if you had any idea about the way things would conclude, but finally the way things did come to an end with the fall of Saigon in April of 75. What was your reaction to that?
Oh, a huge disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I thought about those 58,000 guys that had got killed,
mm-hmm.
and all the manpower and resources. And then from what I've read and understand since, you know, we failed to keep them supplied with ammunition and the supplies they needed to fight the war.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, it was an extreme disappointment. We fought the war wrong, and then we didn't keep them supplied with the war materials that they needed to just to maintain the status quo.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
It was such an easy way to... The thing could have ended, to my way of thinking, in a couple of years.
Okay.
And, you know, finally we mined Haiphong Harbor.
Right.
And cut off the supplies there. And, you know, they were so afraid of offending Russia and China.
Right.
That we just played patsies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the way to fight a war.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, that brings up some of the larger questions, some of the broader issues that I usually like to close out the interview with. So if we could, we could
sure.
talk about some of those. Well, first off, looking back on your experiences and your service in Vietnam, how do you feel about American involvement in Vietnam and about your own service?
You mean, did I think it was justified going over there?
Yes, sir. I suppose so. Yeah. And also about how you feel about your service as well.
Well, I thought we were justified in there to go over there, and the concept was good.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it was just the way we executed it
okay.
was not right, and there was no way to win the war, the situation. And we allowed the thing to continue to exist through a couple administrations of doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The people there, the ones I knew and associated with, wanted freedom.
Yes.
And the farmer out there in the field just wanted to do his job. You know, he just wanted to be left alone to tend his rice crop and ride his water buffalo and not bother anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have ended, I really believe, in a couple years. And so what we did, we just strung it out and then failed to support them.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that the to go over there was the right thing. It's just the way we did it was wrong.
Okay. Yes, sir.
My
so,
career,
okay.
I had a grand career. Maybe a few other duty choices that I should have made, and I didn't, but I have no regrets on it.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, getting back to the way the war was handled for a moment,
uh-huh.
So you feel it is then that we should have taken the war to the enemy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, I think, you know, we proved that later in the war, when they walked away from the negotiating tables,
mm-hmm.
and we had that Rolling Thunder, I think was the name of the campaign, that just bombed the Dickens out of Hanoi,
mm-hmm.
and a couple other ones, and you know, that got them back to the conference table.
Yes, sir.
But that's the only way that you can do it. If you let me just say, Americans have too much scruples sometimes. You know, they're afraid to. War is not a game. It, you know, it's a life and death situation,
mm-hmm.
and we want to play it by the rules,
yes, sir.
That are our making. The enemy doesn't have any rules, and so that's where we have our biggest failing. I just read something yesterday in the American Legion magazine that said that in Afghanistan, the U.S. and the other allies are thinking about forming some sort of a war called restrain. I don't have the exact terminology, but it's restrain violence war or something, where you withhold fire in situations where you could. And I think that's wrong.
Mm.
I mean, if a guy's under fire,
right.
you don't wait to get shot
right.
before you pull the trigger. And Americans don't seem to understand all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my big bugaboos. You know, and until you get in an environment like that, it's hard to understand it.
Right. Yes, sir.
But yeah, they could have done a lot over there. I'm firmly convinced. And I've talked to pilots, you know, and they had. In fact, I work with one close Navy pilot, and they had, of course, had to have every target pre-cleared. And if they saw a target of opportunity on their way back to the ship, they had to get clearance, and the clearance had to come from Washington. In other words, if they saw a truck convoy down there, they couldn't arbitrarily take it under fire in the north.
Right. Yes, sir.
They had to get clearance from our boy McNamara and his wonder kids.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
There was a real jerk.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. We're going to get your feelings on some of the other issues surrounding the war, such as the media coverage of the war. How do you feel about the way it was covered?
Oh, my God. You sure you want this?
Sure. If you...
Well, you know, when the war started, it was sort of like the general population. Everybody was supportive by the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time it ended, the news media was just hammering the military.
Yes, sir.
And it was literally years before the military built up again any type of credibility. Between the peace movement and the media, the left-wing media, it just... skewed all kinds of information, and you know they were looking, I guess, for things that would sell stuff. But CBS, as I think, was the worst.
Okay.
And ABC was probably the best as far as from a military standpoint, reporting unbiased.
Yes, sir. All right.
Well, you still have people, you know. And you had people like Jane Fonda,
right? Yes, sir.
Was over there and riding around on any aircraft guns with a helmet on with a red star in the front, you know. And
right.
And my way of thinking, she should have been brought back here and tried as a traitor. But
yes, sir.
Here we're at war with a country, and she's over there doing her thing. I won't let any of her movies or anything else in my house.
Sure.
I have the utmost hate for that lady.
Yes, sir.
Not lady. That's the wrong term, but I'm not going
right.
to signify this.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, how do you feel about U.S. policy towards Vietnam today, the growing trade that we have with Vietnam, tourism to Vietnam, veterans going back, all of that?
Yeah. You know, when that first started, Jason, I had a lot of trouble with it from a personal aspect, but I think I've grown out of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something that's going to happen. And, you know, that you asked me, I think, the other day whether I was ever go back.
Mm-hmm.
And my answer is no.
Yes, sir.
But I know, and I've read about a lot of guys that go back. A lot of these people that are in counterpart organizations go back, and they've got people they adopt and stuff. But I don't have any problem with it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's too long gone to worry about it. There's other issues, and
yes, sir.
It's going to happen, and there's no need for me to even get concerned.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, just a few more questions.
Sure.
Have you ever visited the Vietnam Wall? And
yes.
What did you think of it?
Very emotional. I was stationed in D.C. from 1974 till I retired in 1981.
Okay.
And the mall was not constructed until, I think, 1982.
Mm-hmm.
So it was after I left. And I went back there in, I think, 95 or 96.
Okay.
And that was the first time I'd seen it, the only time I'd seen it. And it's a very emotional place, you know, and I didn't think it would affect me that way. But it did. And I'd been to, well, before that I went to one of these, the moving wall.
Yes, sir.
Up a little north of here, 80 or 90 miles, and then later they brought the thing to my hometown.
Okay.
And it was in what we call our Coliseum, and I live right across the street from it.
Okay.
So I was there, but your question was about the one in Washington, and it's a terrific memorial. I give them a donation, monetary, every year, and I remember a guy came up to me. He was there, and he was talking to me. He said, "Wonder if I know if I'd been over there?" And I said, "Yeah." And first time, and he said, "Well, welcome home." You know, I thought it was kind of funny because I came home in 70,
right?
And this was 25, 26 years later, but it still had a meaning.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Sure did.
All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say, or anything we haven't covered at this point?
We've covered just about everything.
Okay.
Now, I don't have anything else that I'm aware of.
All right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, this will bring the interview to a close then.
Okay.